No need for the intro here. You know what podcast you're listening to. No ads either on this one. Kind of cover that a little bit with the YouTube intro. When I sat with this amazing guest that we spoke with, just Tony Wright blew my mind. I mean, I even go brain dumb somewhere in this podcast to where I lose my notes, I lose questions, my mind webs out in so many places. You know, just to preface it, because, you know, Tony can get deep, complicated, web everywhere. I had also done a lot of research prior to this podcast, so a lot of questions I typically would have had, or you may have during this podcast, I didn't ask because, well, I had answered them deeply researching and, well, got scrolled off and didn't get a chance to get there. But essentially, I try to say this in the podcast to help you understand where he's coming from, but what he ended up doing over the last 20 years is he took a closer look at the evolutionary sciences, if you will, as well as molecular ecology of our distant ancestral environment, meaning how were they put together, if you will, way back in the day in the environment? How was the environment affecting our ancestral people, if you will? And then he took the research from behavioral researchers, psychologists and psychological research and neurological data, which we have a lot of nowadays, especially and focused really on the neurological data that involved split brain research, which is the right and left brain research, and looked for common denominators, right? And poses something he may have found, which is, are we really advancing cerebrally, or are we really neurologically degenerating? But see, we're so focused on we must be advancing that we may not even see what's really happening. And I think Tony at least presents enough to where we got to ask this question and dive into it. And again, like I always say on every podcast, if your first response to anything really is an absolute, well, then that's a good place to start to question. And if your absolute response is no, well, then maybe open that up and listen with an open mind on this podcast, because it really opened up mine. But I really thoroughly and cerebrally enjoyed this guest. He's the author of the originally titled Left in the Dark, Biological Origins of the Fall from Grace, Initial Reaction to a Transgenerational Epigenetic Theory of Human Evolution and Its Impact on the Development of Our Brain, which is retitled a year later to Return to the Brain of Eden, Restoring the Connection Between Neurochemistry and Consciousness. That's the book I suggest you order as well, or now. But this was an amazing, amazing time, full of competence. I hope you enjoyed as much as I did. This is my guest, Tony Wright.
Welcome to the Cognitive Rampage podcast. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage as usual. This rampage is going to get deep, at least for me. But before I get into the guests, a couple things to tell you about. Dollar Mental Health Club is coming back soon in January. Don't worry. So the beta test will be running in January. We finished the alpha test already, but Dollar Mental Health Club is bringing you basically mental training, not psychology, not therapy, not talking about your feelings in childhood, more or less, but more tools in the present that you can apply in your life. But Dollar Mental Health Club is coming back in January. The second thing to tell you is the second edition of the Cognitive Rampage book. Actually, the revision will be out January of 2017, along with the audio book as well. So this is the last time you can get the book ever printed like this again. We're actually discontinuing the first edition, so we're not even going to print it like that again. So just the second edition will be available. And go to drinkmycotea.com. Something I drink, something I love. Actually, Alfred, I appreciate it. Need one more case again, Alfred. The last one you sent me last week is almost gone. But anyway, the pH balance of the water is what is most important there. It's about 2.4, 2.5. That's what I like the most, but it also has mushroom probiotics, all natural, etc. But go to drinkmycotea.com and you can have more of that. Have you ever found yourself, I often find myself, thinking that I swear we're moving backwards as a species. And I have found myself looking at, sometimes even myself, but us as a whole, you know, not borders, you know, divided, but as just a whole, as a complete species. And I've really thought, I mean, are we moving backwards, right? Technology sometimes, I think, can confuse us as to think we're advancing. But the guest on my show today has taken that question and really ran with it. I mean, maybe even behaving or thinking that way is true, that we are digressing. I mean, if anything, Tony Wright, who's on the show, deems at least it needs proving wrong. And he has taken a closer look at evolutionary context, molecular ecology of our distant ancestral environment, and has included behavioral psychology and neurological data involving split brain research. Right now, split brain, we all know, right brain, left brain, gathered all that together and looked for common denominators. Tony Wright, welcome to the show. Thank you for coming on.
Hi, Adam. Thanks for having me on. It's an interesting subject area, that's for sure.
Well, as I said just before we went live, I feel like, I know we just met technically, but I feel like I'm so deep in the theoretical mind and expansion of you that I feel like I'm kind of like, all right, this is semantics. Hi, how are you doing? My favorite color is black and blue. You know, nice to meet you. So, wow. Let me just tell you, I posted on the Facebook page, I am down a new rabbit hole, and my God, have I been disappeared in this rabbit hole for the last 3 days. So I appreciate it, Tony, for giving that information and to run with.
Well, I've been down that rabbit hole for about 20 odd years, so it's been my whole life.
It has been, and thank you for one. But you know, before we really dive into, oh my God, who knows where we're gonna go? But tell me more, kind of about you, you know, if you will, the back end. Where do you come from? What brought you to this part of your journey in life?
It's a good question. Not one I ever like answering, but I'll give it a go. I didn't set off with any of this in mind. I had a pretty average upbringing for the UK. I grew up in Northeast England, I guess, kind of working class background. And my whole life was like a lot of people, you know, how to get a job, get some money, go to the pub, get drunk, and that was pretty much it. I guess I got a bit disgruntled with that kind of lifestyle, and eventually I went to college, and I grew up thinking I wasn't too smart, so I was quite surprised when I did okay at college, and I ended up going to Edinburgh Botanic Gardens. They ran a course there. I was there for 3 years. And that kind of stimulated interest in plant evolution primarily, but also started, I guess I was moving in a wider circle of friends. It wasn't just the sort of traditional alcohol culture of the northeast of England. And I guess with a little bit of education, enough to get a basic handle on things, and meeting new people, including, I guess I had friends who were interested in things that to me at the time seemed very bizarre and strange, sort of interested in, say, spiritual aspects of life, Buddhism, shamanism, this kind of stuff. So there was some kind of stimulation there that eventually, I guess, led me to start looking at some of those questions myself, questions that probably would never have occurred to me otherwise. You know, the classic, who are we, what are we, how did we get here? And I suppose I started using the tools I had, and was particularly interested in the ideas of our forest origins, which are fairly well established. This, you know, it's pretty central to Western thinking that certainly for a long, long period we're in the forest, and having a little bit of a handle on plant biochemistry and so on. It struck me that this was a particularly unique relationship, particularly rich relationship. So I guess that's where the seeds were sown. And amongst other things, this is going back now to about 1991, I was interested in our ancestral diet. So I started a bit of self-experimentation. I change my diet, although I'm not so keen on the term diet anymore. I think it's much more akin to extremely advanced molecular engineering. That's what we're doing. We might think it's just something we eat, but that's not really what's going on. But I made some changes, and I tried to move towards what I thought was a more natural primate-like diet. Obviously, I couldn't replicate it exactly, but just unprocessed natural foods. More as an experiment. Again, still at that time, I didn't have any grand plans. It was just, oh, well, I wonder what this will be like. I'll give it a go for 3 months. And it ended up lasting for a lot more than 3 months. After about 2 or 3 years, I began to notice some mild but quite tangible changes in my, I suppose, my general perception and thinking, the way I, you know, the way I thought about things, more visual processing and memory. Nothing, no kind of great epiphany, just enough to keep my curiosity sort of piqued. And I guess that then took me into some of these other areas, the sort of more shamanic traditions and so on. And by that time, I'd started doing a lot of reading, and I began to notice these common patterns, I guess, from all these different traditions. And that led me to further self-experimentation, really putting combinations of things together, and going from a very skeptical and very, I don't want to sound too harsh or judgmental, but a very limited outlook, I suppose. I began to get glimpses of things that I'd heard distant rumors of in, you know, strange texts and so on. I thought, well, wow, this is pretty full on. So quite early on, I guess I got enough stimulation to really turn what was a curiosity into what became undoubtedly a bit of an obsession. And I started running into all these classic big questions. And not that I'm suggesting I've come up with answers, but I really felt like there were some simplistic areas here that really nobody had looked at in context anyway. So that was kind of the start of it, about 25 years ago. And I sort of embarked on a process of more and more self-experimentation, more research, and really trying to make sense of some of these questions, and including questioning the equipment I had to make sense of those questions, which I felt was very important. And again, something we certainly in modern culture, we take for granted. We sort of wake up and we, you know, well, I feel okay, or maybe I don't, but we don't really question the equipment that's telling us who and what we think we are. So that was something I factored in quite early, and I think that was quite useful. It was, you know, looking at some of the modern literature, there was plenty of evidence that there are serious perceptual gaps that by definition we don't see. So we blithely go on thinking what we think without ever questioning that. So I guess that was the foundation. And from there, slowly, pieces started coming together. And eventually, 20 odd years later, I have this kind of working hypothesis that is really about asking questions and trying to encourage debate in areas that certainly in the modern era, we seem to have lost. I think our distant ancestors were equally obsessed with these questions, but we've almost lost the ability to understand their language. You know, it's almost too contextual, too poetic, so we tend to dismiss it as being primitive.
Well, 400 questions go from there. I mean, one, I understand self-testing and obsession once you come up with a theory and an idea and approach to life. And but what you propose really in the theory that you base with the right and left brain, right? This dominance over one, because if you asked anybody, I would even say probably have answered until I dove deep in your research that, yeah, we're getting smarter. Yeah, our brain, we're evolving more. But then when you connect it to language, you know, I'm a freestyle kind of poet, if you will. I can just go off the top of my head. And I don't know, there's something you mentioned in an interview about the beauty in connecting through singing or talking in poetry or connecting that way. I mean, we connect that way in love, right? We write love letters or poetry, right? It's okay there still, but we've become very simplistic. We, you know, words become like a tool of really just not connecting, but exchanging information.
Yeah, I think, or I'd suggest at least that the process that we're going through, and I think somewhat blind to unless you start really looking long and hard in the mirror, is, you know, we use words like rational and we have reductionism in science and so on. And we've kind of been brought up to think of that as become as a sign of our advancement. And it appears to be hardwired these days into our system. But when you start asking the question, allowing the possibilities that, you know, so for example, were the hieroglyphs a more primitive form of communication, or were they so advanced we find it difficult to understand them? You know, we tend to base most of our communication on this kind of various versions of Latin, and it's very rational and it's very this, very that. A bit like metric systems versus imperial systems. They're much easier to understand, therefore they must be more advanced. Well, no, maybe they're just really dumbed down because that's what we can cope with. Of the kind of question, once you start asking that and opening up to the possibility, it's like, well, maybe we have it back to front, and it's not a comfortable idea for most people. But I think if we are as advanced as we'd like to think we are, it shouldn't be a threat to ask those questions. In fact, it would be a sane thing to do, to check in once in a while and really test the context. Are we heading in the right direction here? So even little clues like that, or you mentioned poetry, I think, and even there, we've almost tried to rationalize poetry and singing and analyze it and digitize it and so on. But the sort of the more complex contextual communication that tend to stir feelings, though, again, a nice word for something we don't really understand and so on, you suddenly start finding layers and layers of labels that we think we understand, but actually they just parcel away mystery that we don't have the capacity to experience anymore. And yet there's a trail, or there seems to be a trail back to our ancestors, suggesting they lived that experience more than we did with great ease. They didn't have to decipher it. That's just how they were. And then we've ended up where we are today, where they're kind of marginalized and seen as a bit weird, artistic, or this or that and the other. It's not mainstream anymore. This whole rationalized metric base 10 society is the shiny advanced version. We could have, it's just a question. I mean, I have my own answers, but could we be looking the wrong way down the telescope when we're trying to address these questions? And it's amazing once you set that in motion. I've seen this happen a lot where people just, you know, they come to talks or whatever with the built-in presumption, yeah, we're getting more advanced, that we got rockets, we got jet fighters, we got this, that, and the other. Just allow yourself to ask the question about these kind of subjects or any other subject, and it's amazing what our own mind can uncover once we give it permission.
Well, you do see on some level, right, this transition to go back to getting your own land, right, to growing your own food. You know, knowing where everything's coming from. You see this kind of, I mean, if you look at the biohackers, you look at everyone that, you know, people kind of follow, if you will, that don't think they're following anybody, right? Anyway, when that's all, you see this kind of evolution on some level, right? This return there where people are almost can't wait to get out of their job to retire to the woods or to the cabin, to the island, whatever. You know, you're seeing that. And what we would look back at as, say, primitive, is that more advanced, or is that really moving forward? Is moving to the city and building, you know, the skyscrapers, is that natural because we're human and we're building it? Or is that unnatural because we're following technology as opposed to leaving basically the host of where we come from, right? That's a kind of a different angle to look at it.
Yeah, and again, I think it's a central question, at least in Western culture, and possibly, you know, the answers are a little bit more complex. But generally, when you look at what we've created, and again, I think it's a classic pattern of our dominant sort of perceptual system, we tend to see the digitized version. We see the shiny skyscrapers or the new cars or the technology, yeah, and kind of almost bow down to it. Oh, my God, isn't this amazing? The human experience, honest, you know, find me someone living in those kind of environments who's in a state of joy and bliss. I mean, if we haven't managed to create that yet, what we've created is are these abstract concepts and people within it, you know, they're funneled around like herds of animals or rats or ants or whatever, stress to hell, degenerative disease becoming the norm, et cetera, et cetera. It's not really a very happy picture, but we're sold the idea that this is what we want. So I think there's a lot of layers to it, and I'm not in any way averse to technology, but I think if you put technology in the hands of someone with mental health problems, shall we say, you're going to end up with a very twisted system at the end of it. There might be some advanced technology there, but what's the general direction? And it's not about exploring humanity. It's not about trying to reach a sustainable state where we're all by degrees in a sort of decent state of mind. That's way, way down on the list, if it's on the list at all. It's more about following these abstract concepts. And I think that's a direct product of our current configuration, to put it that way. I think what we're seeing is a product of our mind, and you know, we'll get to this eventually, I guess, but I think our mind's in a state of decline. We're just blind to it for the most part, and we still hang on to some of the threads of advanced technology. And even then, when you chase the supply chains, you chase the origins of technology, pretty much all our technology is based on various forms of slavery. You know, to use the equipment we're using today, if you were to chase the supply chains, there'd be children down mines, there'd be lots of pollution, there'd be stress, there'd be people exploited, etc., to get our shiny bits of stuff that for the most part we don't really need. So I think there's lots of, not that I'm saying anything new here, I'm just trying to put it all in context. I think there's an awful lot wrong with our idea of advanced, and increasingly people are sort of realizing that. I mean, there's always been a periphery of scientists who sort of sat on the edge of mainstream society, probably going back to at least the Greeks or, you know, earlier, looking at what's considered mainstream and shaking their heads in disbelief and what the hell is going on here. And of course, we have that still today with very good cause. It's, you know, and again, it's pointless reading off lists of stuff. We're all familiar with what we're doing to the forests, the oceans, to each other. The best of our technology is deployed to kill other humans. How on earth we can call that advanced in the same context? We like to just separate out the shiny bits and ignore the massive damage to get there.
Yeah, you pointed that out a while ago, which, I don't know, 2013 I first heard it. But when we're a species that we call advanced, but we are making weapons of mass destruction, weapons that kill us faster than we're making weapons that actually heal us or save us, more or less prolong us. But, I mean, we're moving faster in that direction. So I do look at that, and that's why I opened this with saying, have you ever skimmed through Facebook, walked around a city, and thought to yourselves, holy, what are we doing here? You know, like, just are we really digressing? You know, are we looking at that? I kind of want to go back to your research, or some of the stuff that you found with the left and right brain research. But through that, I should say. Now, a lot of people have a general understanding of that. If you could kind of maybe talk a little bit about what that means, where that research comes from, kind of where the foundation stands today on that type of research before we, you know, walk deep down. Because would you agree that that's kind of a foundation in what we're going to talk about as we walk into your theory?
I would say it's the most important symptom of the sort of picture I'm trying to piece together, I guess. I have edged more towards the sort of causal factors and how we got to this state, and obviously I'm trying to weave all that together. But the neural configuration, and particularly with reference to the classic left-right brain stuff, I'd say that's the cutting edge of the symptomology. And again, there's reasons why we've become blind to that. But yes, I mean, there's nothing new in that sort of idea. It's, I guess, Western science has been studying this for as long as there's been Western science, and there's hints of it going way back. The idea of at least sort of two distinct versions of ourselves, and that did come out in the 50s or 60s, where each hemisphere seems to have a distinct personality. And various traits have been assigned to that. And there was a sort of general public perception left brain's analytical, logical, speech, right brain is creative, and some other weird stuff we don't understand, basically. I think there was a lot of, or there was some discomfort in academic circles. It was too simplistic, and how could we explain it? The sort of general talk at the time was of specialized adaptation that our left hemisphere seems to be perceptually dominant. The presumption was it must be more advanced, and we've somehow traded these mysterious things we can't easily quantify and don't experience as well as maybe we used to for this abstract thinking. And of course, the risk with that is it's very self-referencing. It's one hemisphere going, oh, well, this is how I see the world now. It must be more advanced because that's how I would see the world now and see that it's more advanced. I'm running ahead of myself a little bit there. So yeah, back to the basics. Pretty much all mammalian species and other species, we have a neural system that's split in two with a connecting bundle of nerves. And what came out of this research, particularly in the 50s, 60s, 70s, was it seemed that each hemisphere had distinct traits, distinct abilities. And there was research using people who'd had accidents, one side of the brain was damaged or the other. Split brain patients were in I think treatment for things like epilepsy and other significant conditions. There was experimental approaches to cut some of the connecting tissue between the hemispheres, so you got hemispheres that were acting more independently. There were other experiments using anesthetics where you could anesthetize one hemisphere more than the other, all sorts of stuff like that. And this pattern emerged that certainly our left hemisphere appeared to have general day-to-day perception, shall we say, our sort of who and what we generally think we are. It was dominant for speech, which has generally been presumed to be the kind of crowning glories of human evolution. It sets us significantly apart from most other species, and therefore it must be advanced and so on. And this persisted in various forms until, I guess, 15, 20 years ago, there was more questions began to be asked about this, particularly with the advent of neural imaging equipment, where experiments were being done, where there was an expectation, oh, well, if it's a simple split, you're going to get activity in one hemisphere and not the other, and so on. And as this imaging data came out, it looked to be a lot more complicated than that. You'd get lights going on in both hemispheres for tasks that were presumed to be more specialized. So there was a general trend then to dilute or dismiss the simple left-right brain theory, and that still persists today, yet it cannot address these experiential experiments where you had people with one or the other hemisphere due to surgery, or one hemisphere that had been significantly damaged, or the other. So there was a real-life experience going on there, not an interpretation of imaging data. And the experiences in that early research, I think, has been somewhat glossed over, in part because it was difficult to make sense of it, and in part because of the imaging data. But it's been a really good review recently. A chap called Ian McGilchrist, I don't know if you've heard of him, he's written a book basically about the left and right hemisphere. The left, right and left hemisphere is the master and emissary or something like that, I think is the title. And he reviewed all the left-right brain research from way back, right the way up till, you know, about 4 or 5 years ago when the book was published, and clearly makes the case that this idea that it's not a simple dichotomy is false. There is actually still a very, very powerful dichotomy there. And where it gets interesting, of course, is we're talking about this, we're analyzing it, but we're trapped in the system of dichotomy to even try and figure out who and what we are. So I think it's interesting to start looking at that data and look at the possible limitations of a dominant hemisphere. And when you start looking at them, and it's in the literature, it's not something I've invented, it immediately, to me, it brings with it a sense of great caution about presuming we know absolutely anything or jumping to any conclusions and being incredibly aware of our bias and our preconceptions, because it looks from the data that our dominant hemisphere has some serious, serious cognitive problems. And that's been observed by some of the most, you know, highly thought of neurologists for their time. And yet we've still kind of marched on from that research as if there's nothing wrong. You know, it's like we see this data, or there's some serious deficits in our capacity, for example, to one of the traits that came out of the research is the left hemisphere is very poor at context. Cannot join pieces of information together very well and make sense of them. Two or three bits of information, yeah, okay, you can cobble them into a picture and so on. You have a whole array of information and it just cannot cope. It's overloaded, doesn't know what to do. So we have reductionist science. It's an advanced way of looking at things. Well, it's not. It's an inability to see the whole picture. It's breaking things down into tiny little bits so our not very bright left hemisphere can actually see them and make some sense. But we've grown up with the idea that this is a great way of looking at stuff. Another thing the left hemisphere has a propensity to do, and again, it's in the literature. I'd invite anybody to check on this. A term called confabulation. It's kind of a fancy word for saying all the time, and it doesn't even know it's doing it. And this is our dominant hemisphere. In addition, and I'm citing some of the key examples. It's susceptible to delusion. It's highly deluded. So I'm just throwing a few traits in there. This has come out of very modern research. But if you were remotely sane, it's like you go to the consultant, you go to the MD, the GP, for a checkup, and they say, well, unfortunately, we've detected a problem with your neural system. There's a problem there. It's going to cause you all these cognitive impairments and behavioral difficulties. You'd be alarmed, and you say, okay, well, I'm gonna stop flying my jet. I'm going to stop driving my car. I'm going to stop what I'm doing until I figure out what's going on. We march on belligerently as if there's nothing wrong, despite evidence and behavioral evidence. But again, I'm running ahead here with little bits and pieces, but just trying to give you a flavor of some of the areas that intrigued me, that I felt I was reading about our collective and my own madness.
I'm
very well researched. And we've not acted on it.
Chair. Tony, I'm jumping out of my chair. The tidbits of information are like little, I'm jumping out of the water like a shark on a seal right now. These are the thoughts that I've, part of the rabbit hole I've just like entered. Like those are the first couple like entrances, like walking into your work and thoughts. And, you know, as a mental health counselor, right, and seeing this emergence you've talked about and briefly touched on, the emergence of mental health illness, if you will, and different types of it and different variations of it. And, I mean, you can almost see that, right? You see us going mad, if you will, or going primal almost, right? Returning to this primal nature, if you will.
Yeah, I think it's a combination. I think we're part seriously mad in a not very good way, but this part of us still has.
Sorry to cut you off. I remembered one point, and this emergence. I wanted to be more specific of this personality disorder, this narcissist, the antisocial, this ability to cut off emotion, logically think ahead, and then when you mention lie to yourself, I mean, this part is huge because I know you're only mentioning symptoms. And you're basically proving the point of your theory ahead of time just by mentioning symptoms of it. I mean, in the book, I talk about creating perceptions based on what we experience is a superpower that we can choose. It's psychology. It's how we do that. But some people, aka every politician on the planet, somehow has the ability to go, this is just, this is right, right? I mean, we do it personally, right, about what we do with our neighbor or the guy who cuts us off in traffic. You see that. You find this, I can play checkers, right? The person can play checkers. I can move here and here. But if it has to move beyond to like 10 chess games at once, to which is the life we lead, that is too much. And you see in psychology, I would bet on the response is aggression. That would be my response. If you take the left brain, and just to update people, those trying to, you know, to catch on, is the left brain is the analytical, the math side, the language side. The right is the more creative and empathetic side. And the empathy speaks, when I look around the world, and empathy speaks to the right would be right dominarians. Oh, just look at our history. There's no empathy there.
Well, I think recorded history sums it up, and there's even a clue that we even have to record stuff. You know, because our eidetic, our phenomenal memory, all the data suggests it's right hemisphere, and our left brain is invented a term for its own memory, short-term memory, working memory, because it's absolutely rubbish. But somehow that's more advanced because, we don't want to carry all that information, and so on it goes.
Oh, my God.
Tony,
you got to... you're dropping bombs, man.
This is part of... I mean, you know, we're having a laugh here, but it's a very serious subject. And, yeah. I mean, if you don't have a bit of a laugh with the ego, you'd end up just running away to the hills, I think. But I think that's part of the dynamic I'd like to try and establish, just this idea that, you know, back to those questions, who and what are we? Well, it appears, based on, you know, the general information, that we use our brain. I'm not saying we are a brain, but it seems to be an important piece of equipment in our perception. I think that's a fairly safe thing to say. And if that's working, if it's near optimal, then great, we just get on asking these questions. But if the glitch is in the equipment we're using to ask the questions, then we got a real kind of weird hall of mirrors to navigate. And I think the challenge with Western science in particular, there seems to be a massive gap there straight away, because generally, as far as I understand the scientific principles, and I think there's a lot of merit to them, you do not presume anything. You do not presume your primary instrument of investigation is working. You at least test it, you check it, you calibrate it, and you do that on a regular basis. Well, we haven't done that at all. We've just launched into, well, what's going on here? I know, we'll invent some language and make some equipment and look at the results, now we know what's going on, without ever asking whether the central equipment itself is even remotely functional. And that might sound outrageous, but really big clues that we're not just in, I mean, we're increasingly, we know we're in trouble because of the symptoms of what we're doing to the planet and each other and so on. But going deeper than that, specifically, for example, whatever weight you might describe to this, the very fact that we have ancient traditions, oral traditions, mythic traditions, some of them have been partly codified and written down from all over the globe, much the ancient ones, not the most recent ones, the very ancient ones, it all suggests that one time we were very different, things were pretty cool, and then something went wrong and we've ended up going bonkers, basically. That's kind of what they say. You know, they talk about delusion in particular, more animalistic, more primitive, more angry. So we have those traditions. The fact they exist is interesting. It doesn't prove anything, but it's really interesting. Then we have our collective behavior today. You know, watch the TV, watch something on Google, go out on a Friday night. What do we see? Do we see a highly advanced functional species? No, we see an absolute disaster. And most of us are probably controlling a lot of our emotions and playing by the social rules. There's a mountain of evidence that we've got serious mental health problems. Do we take that into account when we ask these questions? No. You know, is that sensible, or is that a further symptom of more mental health problems?
Yeah, I mean, you made me just kind of think about a question is going, well, because being a practitioner, there's so much, you're killing my mind right now. I'm all over the place. As a practitioner back then, you know, it was diagnosis, right? We begin to label all these things. But now I talk about, look, these are symptoms, right? We're not treating the person, the trauma, the thoughts, et cetera. We're treating all these symptoms, but because we can label it something, we feel better about it. This is what it is, rather than, hey, these are symptoms of something much deeper, in the person. And I like actually how you go further, by saying it's not about something deeper in the person, as these are symptoms, trauma, et cetera, but rather the species as a whole, its brain isn't functioning, as you mentioned, right? To kind of let people know what you're referring to kind of walk people. And I had to walk in with baby steps, and I still am. So the idea that we believe our brain to be functioning and or advancing, or is our brain actually digressing in our behavior, right? And you looked at all sorts of fields, right? And
in looking at what behavior, psychology, what history, all these kinds of things, seeing what were you looking for doing so?
Well, I think you mentioned this earlier. It sounds very grandiose, but it's quite simple. Just looking for simple common denominators, simple patterns. And I think a lot of it's down to the luck of asking the right questions. And they're not new questions, of course. And I mentioned just a few minutes ago about these ancient traditions, which I was blithely unaware of. I mean, I've grown up in a, I guess it's called, you know, some Christian culture, but I didn't pay any attention to that. But I eventually learned there were lots of traditions. And the central theme was this, it comes with a lot of baggage, but this idea of a fall from grace, a degeneration of sorts. And it's, I think it's been used for all sorts of heinous crimes and God knows what. But the pattern of information is consistent through pretty much all these ancient traditions from whichever continent. I suppose once you ask that question, you start looking everywhere, and it's a bit like putting on a form of reality glasses or something. You then cannot stop seeing, whether it's in yourself or people around you or the culture as a whole, what behavior that you're familiar with. And again, this goes back to left-right brain research. The left brain loves familiarity. Hang on to what is familiar at the expense of almost life itself, rather than dare make a change. So what we're familiar with seems normal, but of course we now have 10,000 versions of normal. Maybe they're all great, or maybe they're just 10,000 versions of madness. We all think our own version of madness is sane. And again, once you ask those questions and you're willing to step back a bit like that. And of course, we also have, throughout recorded history, people that we'd generally consider, let's say, above average intelligence, creativity, insightful, and so on, a whole range of people who've come to humans are clinically insane, or similar words. Now, if somebody came up to you and said, hey, mate, you know, I'm sorry to say, but you might go, oh, well, who's this guy? I don't really care. But if you have a whole succession of highly intelligent people who you respect saying, some cognitive problems here, you might start paying attention unless you're so lost in the nature you just ignore it. Well, that's what we have. We have all these people warning us all the time, and yet we still ignore it. And I think all I've done is just ask those questions and looked, as you say, for behavioral traits. If we have a neurological problem, we're going to have all sorts of symptoms, behavioral traits being an obvious one, perceptual traits, including perceptual deficits. Again, you look at the cognitive dissonance that I think you touched on before, the obvious class of politicians. Well, I think there's a really good correlation between the degree of dysfunction that I'm proposing, the symptoms that come with that are increased fear. If you're losing your senses, you tend to become more frightened. Desperate need to create a sense of control. It's an illusion, but you desperately try to create it. So you've ended up, I think, with a cognitive or a neurological problem that facilitates the advancement of people who are more desperate to have control. Neurological systems, that societal systems that encourage people more determined to be in control, that just happen to be less functional. Well, that's exactly what we've got. Not that it's anybody's fault, but the collective left brain dysfunction has created a system in its own image that perpetuates its own madness, in fact, accelerates it, because we let the least functional people decide what to do. And that's insane, surely. And yet we know it inherently. You know, it's not a new idea that the politicians or the bankers or the whoever are crazy. But actually, what we really think about, no, they're clinically insane. Why on earth are these people, through no fault of their own, allowed to make decisions on our behalf? And are those decisions going really well? No, you know, it's a disaster, as you would expect. And back to your point on advancement, we have an account of our history for the last 2,000, 3,000, 5,000 years or whatever, you know, reasonably accurate for the last 500 years. Are things better? Or are we on the edge of self-annihilation? How can that be advancement? You know, we're worried about destroying ourselves. That's not a discussion amongst an advanced species.
Yeah, that's
screaming. It's screaming at us in the face, and yeah, we are reacting a little bit. I think if we really took on board what we're doing to ourselves and where we live, a perfectly sane response would be to weep and to be, you know, in desperate, desperate despair. And yes, some people are, but we're encouraged to do more of the same, the very same thing that's been damaging us. I have to be careful because I get on rants in all these different areas because, you know, it still fires me up. But, you know, my passion has been to try and get below the symptoms and look for causal factors in such a way that might be able to help us. I'm not really interested in joining a club of people who said, yeah, we're insane and that's it. That doesn't interest me. Is it possible to find a causal factors in such a way we can actually do something about it? That's what excites me. And I actually think that's possible. I actually think we already know a huge amount about how our neural structure and neurochemical regime, so the basic structure of the brain and the chemistry that we allow to run through it, correlates with our behavior. We know a lot about that. And our current configuration is clearly not serving us. In fact, it's destroying us. And we know other states exist, and we know there are structural and chemical changes that correlate with that. So at the very least, we're already equipped with enough knowledge to go, okay, do we want psychopathic people in charge, or do we want more empathic people in charge? Not as a complete solution, but as a starting point. And we know enough about that already. But it's so deeply conditioned into us to hang on to that familiarity that we march off the cliff smiling as everything's okay, and it's far from okay.
Wow. Yeah, right when I have one question, there's six other points that you drop. And, you know, you spoke on a few things about the AKA advancement, you know, of who we are and the annihilation of us as a species, that at one point life may have been, you know, much harder when we look at it as far as conveniences or luxuries, et cetera, right? And we compare it to that, and we have our thinking that just drives us forward, right, without looking. And, you know, the emergence, if you will, of the left brain rather as opposed to the right brain. I kind of want to go back there if we can. What is it? Do you propose that it's a natural evolution that is making the left, you know, be dominant, that we're heading that way? And I mean, knowing what may be causing that, right, is kind of where to start about how we undo that or plug in the other side.
Sorry, Adam, I got some of that. I think I got most of it, but you're breaking up a bit. I don't know if I'm still coming through okay, but your vocals are breaking up a little bit.
Yeah, no worries. I'll try again. The perhaps the question was all over the place because my brain is. If you and I are really walking and talking about here is the dominance of the left side of the brain as it's beginning to dominate more and more of our decisions about what we do, how we do it, how we grow, how we advance, et cetera, you know, looking right in front of us. And what would suggest, not just suggest, but I think we've been talking about what suggests, but, you know, what are the causes, if you will, making the brain maybe allow this to happen, allowing the left side to take over and ignoring the right side, if you will?
Okay, I think I get that. It's a little bit broken, but yeah. Well, this is going, you know, back in the early 90s, I got quite excited when I started reading about some of these neurological experiments, and it just seemed so obvious. It kind of jumped out at me, and again, combined with personal experiments, that, oh my God, it's in the literature. We have a really stupid dominant hemisphere. It's terrified, it lies, it's deluded, it's subject to all sorts of crazy stuff, and it's in charge. Hello, we don't need to. You don't need to know anything else. And we have this ancestral message telling us the same thing in slightly different language. And of course, the next question: Well, why did that happen? The implications from these traditions are: at one time, it wasn't like that. And of course, it's easy to, you know, there's obviously people written about our sort of tendency for nostalgia and presuming things in the distant past were better. what I was looking for was a plausible mechanism where maybe that was the case. And because of the sort of the general background I had with plants and plant evolution and so on, it didn't take long to sort of see how that could have happened. And it's already in the literature. And I guess there's a few preambles to this, so please stop me if I get a bit lost in it. But I think with the advent of kind of Darwinian theory and so on, which it's obviously an ongoing work and some people are critical of it, but I think it's been pretty damn good at explaining a lot of things or offering an explanation for the emergence of species and evolution and all the rest of it. And we seem to be the only species engaged in that process, kind of looking into ourselves a little bit. So there is some uniqueness there, or it would appear that way. And I think there was so much expectation that because so much had been answered by this general theory, that we would be able to answer our own history with the same kind of approach. And explain some of our unusual traits, our unusually large brain, our apparent or alleged intelligence, and a few other traits and so on. And I think in combination with some of the early fossil finds in what were presumed to be non-forest environments, you put these things together and there was an expectation almost that the answer to these questions was hostile environments, competition, the classic drivers that have explained a lot of things. And that's kind of understandable. Even though it was understood even then, and certainly more so now, that for the longest part of our evolution, we were living a very different life. We were living in the forest dwelling species. And not only that, we weren't just living in the forest. We had a very, very bizarre and very unique relationship with the forest. So I got to thinking, well, okay, unique traits in humans, or fairly unique, shall we say, what are the unique things in our history? So you look at that, and the thing that jumps out immediately, or it did to me anyway, is that this relationship with the forest, well, actually, it's what's called a symbiotic relationship, a very close evolutionary entangled relationship, where we were ingesting the sex organs of the flowering plants. Flowering plants are just the sort of generic name for the forest trees and so on. It's a class of the plant kingdom, which is dominant in the tropical forest. So the plants that flower, and then we think of fruit, well, it's a snack, it's this, that, and the other. It's a highly advanced evolutionary organ designed to propagate or to reproduce, for the plants to reproduce. Well, we formed a relationship with this sex organ, ingesting it. That we existed by eating the sex organ of a whole other kingdom. You think a little bit about how weird that is. If I said to you, well, I've done some research, and to eat, the human brain expanded because we chased mammoths and we cut off their sex organs and ate them, and the weird biochemistry of mammoth sex organs expanded. You go, well, that sounds really crazy, man. But we did eat mammoths because, well, actually, we spent tens of millions of years in the forest doing exactly that with plants, eating the sex organs. So what's the connection there? Well, the reproductive organ, the sex organ, is a hormonally highly unique environment. It's designed to do something very different to the rest of the body, rest of the physiology, whether it's in animals or plants. It's all about hormones, and it's all about creating a very unique environment. So I'm trying to get to the point. What we were doing effectively, and I emphasize effectively, is you're taking a mammal, a fairly typical mammal, the mammalian genome, the mammalian brain, nursing it, productive organ of all of the kingdom, and live for millions of years. That's what we were doing when we had this relationship with plants. We're flooding ourselves with plant biochemistry. It's got a weird hormone reactor profile. It's designed to create a juvenile environment for the, as we call them, seeds. Creates this very specialized environment, and the seeds develop. Well, that's what we were doing. So that's what jumped out at me. That is so bizarre. And there's a lot more we can talk about. I'll stop there.
Yeah, I would listen for
hours, but actually, you know, something new jumped in my head. And you were talking, even when we look at history, we look at luxury when we relax, right? It's always kicked back somewhere, relaxing, eating grapes, right? It's always eating the fruit. This is always the luxury of the history we know, you know, kings and queens. This is what it was, right? These were luxury thing. Fruit around was, to have that around was a luxury. And, oh man, you touch on so much. It with too many questions that run through me. When you start talking and go on rants, I think I've met my match on what I call the cognitive rampage, where somebody
okay
goes down on a topic or a development. And let's see, look, I sat here and listened to you for like 3 days, Tony, and I was listening actually about 2 weeks ago and wrote down something that I wanted to. How do you handle trying to grasp thinking that your own development is in digression, in the species that you live amongst doesn't know it as it plows forward into a loss of humanity almost, and doesn't realize it, or even is not even willing to take a look at this possibly even happening?
It's a really good question. And I think a mixture of responses. There's a, in some ways, there's a sense of hope, actually. I think if our collective behavior is as good as it gets, if we're fully functional, if there's nothing particularly wrong with our neural system, oh my God, then I can't see any hope, to be quite honest. If it turns out that there's a pretty serious neurological cognitive problem that in principle we could treat and change very rapidly, then even if we're blithely unaware of that, that's still hopeful. There's still a possibility there. So that's kind of what I've latched onto. It's like, okay, it looks pretty mad to me. I'm not alone in that. Many people over however long think things are pretty dire, and increasingly we look like we're hell-bent on our self-destruction and at the very least creating the most miserable lives we possibly can. Within that, if there is a serious problem, it opens up the door to radical change. So I guess that's what I focused on. But, sometimes it's felt like overwhelming, and obviously, I've questioned my own sanity many times, but that kind of goes around in circles because, well, you know, if I'm completely insane to think this, and how to explain that level of insanity, and why have other people thought like this, and so on. So it does drive you a little bit bonkers, but I guess that comes with the territory, really. And it, as I say, it offers an explanation to me that it makes sense. It makes sense. And wherever you go, you see it more and more. Once you open that door, you cannot not see it. So that can be frustrating, but I guess you learn to live with it. And you know, I've not really stopped in the last 20 years to try and move forward, to find ways to explain this better, to make the case better, to get people interested, and obviously to test the water, because maybe we are fine, maybe everything's okay. But increasingly, in fact, I have to admit that I'm past the point of being convinced now that that is the case. I try and remain objective, but it would take a miracle to convince me that humans are actually sane anymore. So I find it potentially hopeful, but equally it's very frustrating when you're with your own limits, because obviously I have this condition, I have my own limits, and you're trying to move forward with an idea that runs straight into all sorts of preconceptions. It frightens people, it overwhelms people, people want to dismiss it, people don't want to talk about it. I mean, some people do, and increasingly people are, and that's great. But it is a little bit like precognition of something. I don't know, like there's an asteroid coming, for example, and all right, it's a dream, but you know for damn sure it's real, and you're sort of saying, well, hey, we need to do something about this, and the initial response is somewhat disappointing, to say the least. But you know, what else can you do? I mean, until, I think you mentioned in the intro, until somebody comes along and categorically blows a big hole in this can't be right, it's absolutely, you know, it's your own insanity, everybody's fine, okay, nobody's convinced me of that. And increasingly, you know, I'm getting a good response to this from a broad spectrum of people, and that's quite hopeful, you know, from academics, anthropologists, neurologists, right the way through to artists, to psychonauts, to, you know, right the way across is, oh my God, this actually makes more sense than anything else. It's scary. Out, and that's the bit that excites me. So yeah, mixed bag, but generally, I wouldn't be doing this, I wouldn't be working on this if I didn't think there was an end game that could potentially turn us from terrified, aggressive, self-destructive species into a species that could live a little bit like these ancestral ideas where we were. You know, a little, I mean, you know, I draw on all these analogies and some of them read experiences where I guess you're familiar with, you know, the rave culture that emerged and where MDA came from a sort of obscure invention way back whenever to became a sort of dance drug. And for a couple of years, it was, you know, or at least there were elements of it where it was not about profit. It wasn't in criminal hands. It was just about spreading a vibe, really. And the transformative effect that had on people, not just people who were already like into dancing and having that, but people who were really angry and wanted to fight each other, it had the power to transform. And obviously it's now been trialed for post-traumatic stress, all that kind of stuff. Now, I'm not saying we're deficient in MDMA. What I'm saying is one molecule had the potential to transform a consciousness. We've lost hundreds and hundreds of equally complex molecules from our forest ancestry. You know, we're chronically chemically impoverished compared to our ancestors. If there's not some clues in there, if there's not something in there that could answer these questions, then I'd be extremely surprised.
You know, I have a few things to connect. Maybe I write about even, you know, mood modulation, right? People look at addiction, drugs, gambling, jumping out of airplanes, whatever it is, you know, whatever mood modulates, reading, napping, meditation, at mood modulation as being something almost instinctual, right? That you look at a kid that's 2 years old, 4 years old, maybe, I don't know, and uncle's throwing him up in the air. It's repetitively asked, right? Do it again, do it again. The kid just spins around in circles for no reason, drunkly, almost looks drunk, right? Falls. You know, we have this obsessive need for mood modulation almost and pushing ourselves. And then to connect, as we get older, even if you look at many nationalities, nations, whatever, as the species, we look for our getaway, if you will, in nature. We go to the beach, right? We can't wait to get an escape. Well, what people have a hard time swallowing, right, is that time was better then, before we had atomic and hydrogen and nuclear bombs. And so we look at now and go, no, technology means we've advanced because I have better luxuries. I don't work as hard. And we look at the old way of living, if you will, before we could annihilate ourselves with a few buttons. You know, we said, no, it was bad then. It was harder. We've definitely advanced. And it's hard to see that. But guess what? We lived in what you can't wait to vacation to 50 weeks out of the year. 50 weeks out of the year, you're in a city or doing work in this advanced civilization in buildings of concrete removed from where we came from, what birthed us, what kept us alive. And then we can't wait those 2 weeks this year, if some people even get that. And where do we go? We go to the beach. We walk the edge of the water. We go to the woods. We go skiing. You know, a lot of us do that. We immerse ourselves in some sort of nature response of letting go, right? Or returning home even. You know, I reference when I find myself saltwater in the kayak, I've found home. And, you know, it's almost like behaviorally, we seem to be always wanting to go there, but yet our brain takes us further from there.
Well, I agree completely. And, you know, some of those things are now and have been for a long time used as therapeutic approaches, people taken from the city to the woods just to de-stress a bit and reconnect a little bit. And that's insane that we're even having to do that. But yeah, I completely agree. And again, I think it's interesting. There's this dichotomy. I propose that we have our brain generally is in trouble. The left hemisphere, it's degenerating more quickly, and I'll try and explain that in more detail later if we've got time. But it's again going back to this idea that the left brain in isolation, and because it's dominant, that's kind of the influence it has. It's creating a world in its own image. It's sterile, it's cold, it's shiny, it's angular, it's this kind of stuff. So that's what it feels most safe. But of course, we're not just the left hemisphere. And in fact, that's the dominant. It's the least part of us. It's just like the aggressive bully jailer. You know, it's not got much going on, but it's kind of in charge. And there's a deep part of us still alive, but kind of locked in the basement, that has these phenomenal connection with nature. In fact, it's part of who we are. And going back to, you know, I was on a bit of a rattle, and I sort of stopped before people sort of, you know, their ears start bleeding or whatever. But going back to this relationship with the forest, the word symbiotic or symbiosis, and the kind of definition of that is the idea that species, which is kind of a left brain idea anyway, but let's start with that. The idea is that boundary merges and you end up with a new organism made up of one or more species. And if that relationship goes on long enough, you really can't call it a kind of new species. And fully accepted, we had a symbiotic relationship with plants. It went on for millions of years. If it shaped, as I proposed, if it actually shaped, if it facilitated the emergence of a new brain, the neocortex, if that was really a product of this relationship and almost engineered by the plants, it's like our consciousness system and the relics of it are still there somewhere. It's kind of more plant than animal, and that's why we have such an affinity for trees, or we can do. I mean, on the other hand, you look what we're doing to the forest, it's heartbreaking. You know, we're almost destroying ourselves in the most literal sense. But I think that's our true essence, where when we're more connected to nature, we were more connected to nature than we could even imagine. I think we become an integral part of the forest because of this relationship. And we still have the relics of that buried in our psyche. That is when we feel at our best. That is when we feel at our most at ease. And it's, you know, you take someone who's stressed, get them into nature, and they start relaxing straight away. And yet we insist on creating these nature-free zones as if that's where we should live. Well, hang on a minute, that's really kind of weird. You know, that's like taking a fish out of the water and going, well, that's a good idea. I mean, it evolved there forever, but let's put it somewhere where there isn't any water. It'll be fine. I mean, it'll adapt. It'll build an aqua lung. And that's really cool because it's more advanced now. Well, that's kind of what we've done.
Yeah.
And we still accept it, you know?
Oh, I'm sorry that I laugh, because it's almost the only way you can swallow that shit. It's about the only way that you can go. I see that, you know what I mean? We continue to develop in a way, we divide in groups. All right, yeah, that's a place I wanted to go to. You could almost say that we live in a dualistic time, right? That there's, you're on one side or the other, it's some issue, it's some identity and some religion and some belief, right, in this world, this division. Could this division, you know, somewhat have to do with, you know, our dominant sides, a side that we either help cultivate, whether we nurture our left side or whether we nurture our right side, and then we use the psychology to anchor beliefs. You know, I like to talk about there is no truth, that there is no reality. It's just what we shape and create. And if you can come to accept that wildly crazy notion, well, then you have this superpower almost, right, to control what happens.
Well, I would say yes. It is to do with that. I mean, if I can, as briefly as I can, just provide a bit more context, and again, jump in if it goes on too long. But going back to this forest relationship, and I'm going to just throw in some summaries, and hopefully that'll become self-explanatory, or your listeners can follow up later or something. But I'm just going to try and summarize what I think happened. Obviously, this is a proposal. People can take it or leave it. But this relationship with fruit, okay, it's fruit, as I said, is a juvenile-inducing environment, a bit like the mammalian uterus, rough parallels there. So you immerse a mammalian species in that environment, creates a juvenile or a juvenilizing environment, makes us more juvenile, and our brain. And of course, the brain that grows in that environment, by definition, is more juvenile. So you get a new brain that begins to emerge, it's more juvenile, both in its chemistry and its structure and the way it runs a system. So it starts running a more juvenile system, a bit like children. You know, we go through all these phases still now, like a young child, an infant, or a juvenile. They produce hormones that keep them juvenile because they have a more juvenile brain. It slowly changes with puberty and so on. So what I'm proposing happened is this relationship with fruit created a new juvenile brain, began proliferating. It extended our juvenile period, so we had longer time to grow a new brain. And this thing that emerged out the top of the old brain was essentially a juvenile brain, an increasingly juvenile brain. And the bigger it got, the more hormones it pumped that were more juvenile and allowed it to grow bigger and so on and so on. That's a short story. It doesn't really matter about the details. The point I'm making is we ended up, I think, with a new executive, like perceptually dominant layer of neural tissue that was still juvenile in its psychology. And from any negative connotations about juvenile, I'm talking about the best traits of when we're juvenile. So that profound sense of empathy and connection and playfulness and capacity and appetite to learn and so on and so on. There's not the hierarchy, there's not the aggression. I think that's what we had. And I think this applied to both hemispheres. Both hemispheres have effectively been created by this symbiotic relationship. They're both more structurally the same. They both did the same thing. It was a single system, and it worked phenomenally well. It broke down. The forest disappeared for whatever reason. We couldn't, our own mammalian system could support this new brain because it didn't create it in the first place. This is a mistake I think we've made, you know, working for the answers in human DNA. Human DNA is like any old mammalian DNA, just builds a basic mammalian brain. Great for survival, and I emphasize the word mature, tends to be aggressive, competitive, not too empathic, not phenomenally bright, can't learn much. You know, the learning window tends to be when animals are young. I think that's what our brains be reverting back to. You know, we talk about damage or degeneration, but technically, I suppose it's more like the reverting to an earlier form. And one side, just happens to be left side, has reverted more quickly. So now I'm getting to the point. I think what we have now is a brain that's maturing, and you might think, well, great, that's what mammalian brains do, and yes, that's correct, but I think what set us apart didn't mature. It stayed in a juvenile form and brought with it all these amazing traits. And now it is maturing, left side much more quickly, to typical mammalian traits. So that loss of plasticity, loss of ability to learn new stuff, more aggression, more competitive, more hierarchy. And then going into the neurological literature, the left hemisphere in our current form, it doesn't even perceive reality directly. Reality, but we perceive very limited reality with a bunch of concepts. We have ideas. For example, you know, if I was to say to you or your listeners, okay, well, forget about your nationality, forget about your name, forget about your job, take all those labels away, and any labels that come up to describe yourself, take them away. What's the experience that's left? And it's quite hard to do because our mind usually throws up another layer of abstract concept. But what's left when you take all that away? And that's a kind of snapshot of what our left brain can feel. Not very much. It either feels frightened or content if there's no fear. That's about it. That's about the limit of what it can feel. We know somewhere else because it scares the hell out of our left hemisphere, or scares the hell out of us. And usually males feel that more. You know, we're terrified of our feelings generally. Something else can feel an awful lot more stuff, and it still wants to be playful, but we block ourselves. It still wants to be empathic, but we block ourselves, and so on and so on and so on. So I think we've got a near mature mammalian brain, but that's not a good thing, and we've still got a partially juvenile mammalian brain. That's where the relics of the real cool stuff live, and that's why we're always wanting to get into that side of our brain, and that's why some of these chemicals can help because they asymmetrically stimulate the right brain, or we use approaches to shut our left brain down. We tire it out. We take the Trappist approach. We don't speak for days. Well, if it's not speaking, it's like it's not there anymore. You know, it chatters endlessly. I mean, it's a question I ask. And again, it goes back to classic symptom of insanity. Who hasn't got a mad chattering voice in their head? And would you share that chattering with your partner or your closest friend? Probably not all of it, because it's pretty mad in there. That's the impression I get from people. And who's not got that? Well, we've all got that, and we all pretend we haven't. That's another case of classic delusion. You know, we're all kind of mentally ill, pretending we're not. And I think that's part of it. We've got this dominant system that can only run on abstract concepts, labels, and speech. And the flip side of that, and we touched on it before, we have other forms of communication. And before we even broach in the more esoteric forms, I'm just talking about singing and singing in a more poetic way. And the amount of information that can convey, vastly more than speaking, and yet speaking somehow more advanced. So we've got these dichotomies right in front of us. And most of us, certainly in our culture, we've grown up, you know, I'd be frightened to try and burst into song on this interview, and it would probably sound quite bad because I'd be too frightened. But if I could, if we could do this interview operatic style, it would be vastly more entertaining, enjoyable, and contain so much more information. And there's some scant evidence that that was a more normal form of communication going back 4,000 or 5,000 years. There was a kind of more poetic, lyrical form of communication. And I think even that was the relic of something even more interesting. But nevertheless, you know, that's in recent times. So I think you've got all these clues and they all start stacking up. And they all suggest to me very strongly that the problem is where all the ancient tradition said it was. It's in our mind. It's not out there. And it's really tangible. But the lens we're using to focus on this is the lens that's corrupted. And that's in the ancient traditions as well. They all talk about is, you know, going from a singular sense of consciousness that they tend not to say, oh, well, it was similar or it was different or it was a little bit better. They tend to use words like divine and rapture. You know, you might think, oh, yeah, I'd like a piece of that. Phenomenally better. And then something happened. And some of the traditions are quite specific. They talk about the emergence of a new, the kind of form that we now recognize as us today, and this old unified self eventually disappeared or became very hard to access. That's not a correlation with the left-right brain research. It's a perfect match, particularly this talk about sliding into delusion. Right hemisphere being deluded, when it's activated, when it's working, it, you know, it has perfect pitch, it has a deep memory, it can't forget anything, it can read pages upside down by taking pictures of it. All sorts of cool stuff that are, you know, relics of the savant syndrome and prodigious genius. Not just a little bit better, phenomenally better, and often tied in with a more playful attitude. It's almost like getting back to that childlike state. In fact, even some of the traditions, you know, if you want to solve this problem, get into a childlike state. That's not normal adult state. They're frightened and hanging on for grim, bloody, if I do anything childlike. Well, again, I'm rambling on a bit. I'll just do it together eventually.
No, I mean, I think it's right on with even psychology research. It's denial as we get older, less likely to take risk. Right. We look at people of ancient times, right, as crazy, if you will, of believing anything that may be mystical or, you know, use words like divine and rapture. And today things are more analytical. It's definitely more, no, prove it to me. Show me the bottom line. How'd you get there? Even our research, the way we do research today, like you said, is we pull small bits out to try to understand it rather than the abstract big picture. We can't see that. And yet we ignore it and label it as advancement as we march forward in our advancement of degeneration.
You bring up a bit. I caught some of that, but I use the analogy. It's quite harsh, but I think it's accurate, or at least I'm willing to be challenged on it. That I really think the ancient traditions, you know, they come with a lot of baggage, and even we've managed to reduce them. You know, you get into meditation, and that's the only answer. You get into yoga, that's the only answer. You take plant medicines, that's the only answer. You change. You know, it's all become fragmented. But if you step back from that, and instead of thinking about ancient mystical traditions and practices, does it fit if you, in putting in modern dumbed down language, are they describing the onset and progression of a neurological condition? And did they come up with some ingenious treatments? Because if there was a process, if we had this hypothetical, very different full function going on, and it started to erode and started to change, then early on in that condition, as with many mental health conditions, you're aware you have a mental health problem when it's mild, and you would likely take action to try and do something about it. Only as the condition progresses and it becomes, well, I kind of describe it as a form of dementia, like the onset of dementia. Initially, you can have some awareness of that and try and, you know, try and work around it. But as the condition worsens, you eventually slide into a state where you've lost any idea that you have dementia. And I think that's where we're at. And again, it sounds really harsh, but I think that's what our ancestors were warning us about. And not only that, they provided us with some tools, not a solution, because if it was a solution, we wouldn't be having this discussion. But they provided us with some really useful tools that I think are simply treatments for a condition that is universal. And those treatments, once you strip away the dogma and are willing to look at it outside of the sort of dogmatic attachment to any particular belief, what you see, I think, are, well, there is talk in many traditions of, again, what we call diet, but again, I'd suggest forget about diet. This is how do you build and maintain the most complex molecular structure we know, the human brain, phenomenally complex. Well, what we're doing every day is maintaining and rebuilding that. So when you look at what we put in our system, that isn't diet anymore, that's molecular engineering. And we have a lot of choice in that. And we, you know, today, and you know, obviously it's an extreme example, we laughingly talk about junk food. We're building the most advanced system we know from junk, and we think it's funny. I mean, if that's not insane, I don't know what is. But nevertheless, in these ancient traditions, they talk about natural diets and fasting and you know, making those kind of changes as a preparation to applying these other techniques. Then they talk about techniques, and I'm going to call them treatments. So you've got this engineering rebuild going on, trying to restructure the thing. Practices that inhibit the left hemisphere. Why would you want to do that if it's working fine? But if that's the problem, so again, things like I think I mentioned earlier, the sort of silence, the silent retreat, the sort of monastic tradition, the Trappist tradition, where you starve the left hemisphere of the only thing it does to give it sense of self, to self, what we're doing now, blabbing and talking incessantly, either quietly or in your head or whatever. If it doesn't do that, it's like scared. It like, I'm not here anymore. I better make some noise and do some shit or whatever. That's kind of what it does. Or confounding it with contextual problems or unsolvable problems, because it isn't too bright. It loves to think it's intelligent, but it borrows most of the intelligence from what we call the subconscious. It's actually pretty bloody stupid. And again, look at what we're doing. If that's not stupid, I don't know what is. And so on. Other approaches to literally dumb down or tie the left hemisphere, or even sleep deprivation. It's in a lot of ancient traditions. You know, the Buddha meditating for days under the tree. Well, meditation is a form of sleep deprivation. The Epic of Gilgamesh talks about the ancient quest for the lost consciousness. And there were several last challenges. And this is the earliest piece of text we have, is to stay awake for 7 days and seven nights. Well, that all starts to make sense if we have one hemisphere that's in charge, but really paradox, it's in charge, you know, like an arrogant bully, you know, aggressive because it's really frightened and it isn't very strong emotionally. And you're starving the batteries of the left hemisphere more quickly because it's just not very strong. Angry, it's going to get irritable, it's going to get less functional, and it's going to lose control. When do they become more emotional? In the evening time, you know. Daytime, you wake up, you're all rational, you get on with all sorts of boring stuff, whatever. Towards the end of the day, left hemisphere's battery's running down. And that's when we socialize more, that's when we become more emotional. But of course, it's still in charge. Like, right, so this, I'm tired, I'm going to bed. You never break that pattern. But anybody who's, I don't know, building all night, they're at work, got kids, little kids, and they've had to be all party hard for 2-3 days, or whatever. Past that initial tiredness, yeah, it can be unpleasant, but you start getting gaps of something quite odd, where you feel more relaxed, you feel more engaged, you start having, you know, sort of mini mystical experiences. Well, the ancient traditions really pushed that. You know, they talk about staying awake for several days. It's part of vision quest. You switch from abstract to seeing the vision just by staying awake. So you've got this package of things to try and inhibit the left hemisphere. And on top of that, and hand in hand, there's a bunch of techniques to stimulate the right hemisphere. So you've got things like complex movement and sound and dance, things the left hemisphere cannot grasp. You can do basic rhythm, little bit of beat, but you give it complex dance music, which of course is what, you know, reemerged, the ancient trance dance tradition reemerged around MDMA, probably the same basic vibe. You put on complex flowing music, take a chemical that will stimulate that side of the brain, and next thing you're lost in divine dance for hours and hours and hours. And do you feel tired? No, you just feel loved up with everybody. So you've got approaches like that. You've got some of the plant medicines that, or even the modern synthesized versions like LSD. There was a study in the 60s before it was criminalized where it was a really cool experiment, and it's not cited enough, where I think a neurosurgeon in London took a number of patients who were due for left or right lobectomies, i.e. some or all of the hemisphere was going to be removed on either side of the brain. And whatever possessed him to do it, I don't know, but he decided it would be good to give them a trip before the operation and a trip after, just to see the difference. And again, this isn't about interpreting imaging data. This is what actually happened and what people reported. And the general picture was that all those perceptual effects that can come out of psychedelics, that you, let's say the positive effects, they don't seem to occur once you take the right hemisphere away. It's basically a function of the right hemisphere. So that's fascinating in itself. It's an individual fact. It doesn't mean much on its own. But you put it into this picture, and you start looking at some of these, what we might call the more expansive drugs, rather than the ego-inflating drugs, you know, like cocaine or whatever. There's evidence to suggest that they're asymmetrically stimulating the right hemisphere. So you have these raft of approaches. Well, today, again, I mentioned it's like we've turned the mystic tradition into a reductionist tradition, and we do this one thing or we do that one thing. I think our ancient ancestors were doing all of these things simultaneously to try and access the relics of this consciousness. And when you do start putting these things together, the rational mind complains, it's scared as hell because it's going to get pushed out of the way. Doesn't like it. But once it's out of the way, oh my God, the sense of liberation and the stuff that can start to happen is way, way more than the sum of the parts. You know, I've spoken to people who've, you know, done all sorts of entheogens, or people who've done this, that, and the other. Very few of them start putting it together. But when they do, and when it's combined with a biochemical rebuild that we call diet, and remember, that's incredibly complex as well, then you start getting, I think, glimpses of what was a one-time normal function, but it's so different to what is normal function now. You know, your sensory perceptions are enhanced, everything's enhanced, and you feel beyond amazing, yet it somehow feels like it's coming home, and all the classic cliches. We still have the wiring for that. I mean, regardless of what theory explains it, we still have the wiring for that. We know how to approach that. We probably know how to approach that quite safely if we followed the apprentice and education approaches of ancient tribal traditions. That's on offer now, and yet we legislate against it because that's somehow a threat to what we're doing. You know, there's so many layers to this, and yet to me it just comes down to, yeah, we're brain damaged, and the part of the brain that's really damaged is running the show, and as long as that goes on, we're screwed.
Well, when I see it almost, we are finding ways to fight it, right? I mean, we all have our ways, whether it's finding flow state in some way, right, or taking psychedelics, or I've done all of the above, and or finding different ways, right? I spoke about mood modulation in us, like we're all trying to find a way to modulate that mood or go beyond it, but almost access that right side of the brain, that creativity, and shut off that side. But again, when you talked about it being so scary, that it's true that the left side goes, well, I'm not needed anymore, to try to find those ways. And it's almost like we all know it exists and we all fight it, but yet we just allow it. You can see why that interpersonal dialogue, or that battle, if you will, consumes so many people between, you know, self-preservation, analog thinking, doing what you have to do versus, you know,
we've also gotten really kind of creative in all these ways to almost block it out by going, you know, do what you have to do, or you're a provider. We try to find all of these subjective labels in between to deal with the fact that we're trying to be more right brain in our lives. You know, find what you do and love and do that for a living, and then you'll always be happy, right? Be creative. Hell, most of our musicians and artists that we love were heavily into psychedelics or deep, what we would call them, you know, crazy at some point, right? But they made art that was beautiful. I mean, pick a lead singer. I mean, so it's almost like we know it, but I mean, this continued battle. But I love how you talk about being at least aware of the battle that's happening, aware of that right side wanting to exist and live and allow you to cultivate and grow and take care of other people and be empathetic and reconnect with nature. All those things that are fed naturally that way, if we can be aware of that, and at least that's the first step in. That's all I can think of in the psychology world. Because look, I know you studied about 9 different fields and gathered all the left and right brain, the split brain information data to come up with what you were saying. So I'm just waving from the psychology field going, yeah, everything you're saying is right on, you know, from how mental health diagnosis developed to how I even see us developing as a species. I mean, this, it connects so much for us. We chase it. We're born chasing mood modulation so much, but yet we deny it from ourselves. We even beat ourselves up, Tony. We even say, how could you go to that rave this weekend? How could you allow yourself to open creatively and not make sure you follow the 3-step process to being happy?
Yeah, but I guess it's inevitable if we have ended up in this position. It is difficult to make sense of it, that we proactively create and choose stressful and
Tony, sorry to cut you off. I forgot my point is how could it not be degenerative, right? If it doesn't, it's continued, right? Despite all we know, it continues anyway, and we allow that. To me, speaks to a biological, a genetic implication, a morphing, a change, something we're not able to fight. No matter how much we create purpose, empathy, awareness, change, we're fighting something more biological.
Well, I, of course, I'd agree. It's just knowing where to look, and I don't think I've come up with anything new. I've taken quite a lot of a lead from these ancient traditions, and I think they, by definition, if we're at the wrong end of a degenerative condition, or that's one way to describe it, then by definition, our ancestors must have known more. And I'm not talking, I think you mentioned earlier about, you know, our perception of the past and it being more difficult. I've no doubt we managed to create all sorts of difficult scenarios in the last 10, 20, 30,000 years or whatever, and there's evidence for that. I'm talking further back again, where perhaps the last relics exist in some of the tribal communities that have been relatively undisturbed, where there appears to be, at least in a lot of cases, a sort of inherent sense of joy and wonder still, or glimpses of that at least. And I think those are the relics. I mean, even in those tribal communities, they often have traditions, or they generally have traditions, that their ancestors were in much better shape and so on. So I don't think they're immune from this condition at all, but they've managed to retain relics of it. And yet we go out of our way to almost dismiss that, or to relegate that to something that's not important. You know, it's like, what exactly is the end game of Western culture? Where do we see ourselves in 100 or 500 years? What will our day-to-day lives feel like? And that's not on the agenda. It's about this mechanistic concept of what we should be like. In other words, it's not real. It's not what humanity really is. It's this abstracted version, and that's all our rational mind can come up with. It's not doing this on purpose, in the same way that somebody with dementia doesn't do self-destructive things on purpose. It's because they're ill. And I think, again, challenging though it is, once you embrace that possibility that we're mentally ill, then it does explain a lot. But it also kind of it kind of liberates us from any blame, and it gives us the opportunity, I think, to start changing that in a very constructive way. Whereas when we're locked into this narrative of advancement and we need to get on and do more of the same, you know, we're totally lost, and yet we're kind of trapped in that. And it's almost, I don't know, it is almost like a reflection of the battle that's gone on in our mind, I think, where the rational mind has won. It's in charge, but look what it's doing. We've moved closer to self-destruction in the last 50 years than we probably have done in the last 5,000 years or whatever. And yet somehow we still think that's the right thing to do. Surely anything would be better than that. You know, whatever crazy ideas we have would be better than more of the same, because more of the same is going to result in more of the same. That's not, you know, that sounds pretty stupid, but that's what we keep doing. That's what we keep doing, more of the same. And I think there's a classic definition of insanity. I don't know if it was Einstein or somebody came up with it, sort of doing the same thing and expecting a different result is a classic symptom. Well, that's exactly what we're locked into, and we find endless ways to defend it. When I say we, as a society does, but if you look at the structure of our society, it's that diminishing percentage of people who wanted to be in control make those decisions. And unfortunately, the people who really don't want to be in control tend to be sociopathic, less psychopathic, don't have that influence. So the left brain's created a hierarchical system that accelerates this process. It creates institutions. I mean, we create institutions for our children. We brainwash them very early with more of the same, and it gets earlier and earlier, and we accelerate more and more. And somehow we still manage to believe our own bullshit where we say this is advanced. And it's astounding, I think, once you step back to see how I'm running out of kind of ways to describe this, but we should be vastly more shocked than we are at how bad things are, if that makes sense. I think our response at the minute, while there is some sense of response to what we're doing, it's embryonic. It's way out of proportion of the problem. As I say, we should, you know, a sane response to what we're doing would be to drop everything we're doing for fear of doing anything more the same until we figure out what's going on. But we don't. We just keep marching on, if anything, marching faster and faster. And it's scary.
You could argue that the strength of our cognitive dissonance, or the strength of our denial, is on the level of a mental disorder, of a mental personality disorder, actually. You could argue.
Well, I say it's a form of dementia. I use that term quite intentionally. I know it's a harsh term, but I think it's a form of dementia. We've slid into a form of dementia to the point now where it's quite severe. And severe dementia is, you know, we have no idea who and what we are anymore. Yeah, we have some labels and we've all grown up with them, but we don't really have that experience. We just have abstract concepts, and there's 100 different versions now, and many of them are incredibly incompatible, and yet we'll kill each other over them. Now, unless the universe is even more bizarre than our wildest imaginings, I find it highly unlikely that all our belief systems are real. So you start asking the question, well, what is real? What's the essence of all this? And you go back to the common themes of the ancient traditions before they became dogmas and belief systems, where they were more experiential. And the sort of traits that come through sound, again, they sound very childlike in a way, but there's a sort of a sense of divine connection, a sense of joy, a sense of wonder. I suspect those are the real elements of what made us human. And yet those are the things that are becoming incredibly rare now. We can talk about them and we can write books about them, but to experience those things collectively tend to scare the hell out of some of us, because when people do that, they tend to get locked up in prison.
You know, you can talk to an individual and talk about and pick the adjective, you know, whether it's spiritual enlightenment, pick the experience. And as individuals, we're okay to talk about, you know, this beautiful changing moment, whether it was spiritual, whether it was religious, whether it was anything, it doesn't matter. Whatever that experience, we're easy to talk about that maybe, or share that with someone. But it's hard pressed to find somebody that in a giant mass of group of people paying attention will they look at those things, right? You know, unless they're among the same like minds, right? But, you know, another cliche that we all know, that in order to solve any problem is you have to admit there is a problem, right? You can't fix what you don't know is broken. And it seems like that basic principle applies to our species, but we know that on individual things, be that addiction, be that gambling, be that whatever, right? But we don't seem to be okay with going, let's step back and go, maybe our entire species here has an issue. Maybe us as an entire evolutionary species have a brain issue, a functioning issue here. Our cognitive dissonance, I would just start there. If this was like my job, right? If we got put on some like superhero special team, solve the world here, my psychology input would be like, all right, let's start there. Our world is basically at war continuously since our birth. We have lived under the idea of competition is good and resource chase. We basically live under a resource chasing. We'll get to it before you get to it. Strong survive. Since we've been here, some basically the way I see it, it's just been run around, right? And we're in denial of that. From country to leaders to sectors, we just, no, it's good, right? Look at the flag. Look at all our, and then awesome, sing our song. And I would start there. If that was my department of the superhero X games or X Men change the world, I'm like going, psychology department says, yeah, we're fucked up. We have a personality disorder on a major, major severe level right now as a species, and we are in some serious denial of that. And nor do we want to seek help, but we're very aware that we want to change however we feel in the present by modulating our mood any way we can.
Well, I completely agree, perhaps not surprisingly. And I think anybody listening, go to the work of Roger Sperry and Michael Gesaniger and others. And what I strongly suggest, because I think it's in their data, it's so cool when you look at that stuff. If you step back a little bit, I think they've done a fantastic job of producing great data. And the data to me and to them, it seemed, they came up with this stuff. The left hemisphere is perceptually dominant. It gives our sense of who we are, what we are, makes some major decisions. Okay, so you've got that bit. And then they also go on in sort of more detail for your traits, stuff I've already mentioned. So it's in constant denial. It constantly lies. It's frightened. It cannot perceive reality directly. It cannot perceive context, blah, 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 blah. So, I mean, those two things should be enough. If you put those two things together, you think, oh, my God, I've just discovered there's something seriously wrong here. But their own data predicts they'll miss the screamingly obvious. And these eminent researchers who I have a lot of respect for still went on to make the same mistake we've all done. They ignored the data and come up with stories about, oh, well, it must be some specialist adaptation and everything's fine. And the left hemisphere is really cool and blah, blah, blah. So even coming out, there's massive flaws in the, not in the data, but in the conclusions that the left hemisphere writes. Because obviously they're doing research on themselves, whether they realize it or not. And they all forget that they've just described their own dysfunctional left hemisphere, and yet they don't factor that in to their conclusions. So you've got that, and I'd invite anybody to look at that with fresh eyes. Don't buy into current thinking. Don't buy into the conclusions of the day. Just look at the raw data and tell me whether it looks like specialist adaptation or really severe neurological condition. You know, there's a two choices. What does it look like? And then I think going beyond that and going back to what I've touched on a little bit already, but talking about why, we're desperate for mood modulation and so on, and all the kind of stuff around that. If our forest origin, if our forest origins are correct and the evidence supports that, and there's no real debate about that, there's only discussion about when we came out of the forest, and a presumption that the sooner we got out of the forest, the sooner we could build a big brain, even though big brains actually grow in the forest anyway. But looking at the chemistry, okay, tropical forests, general consensus is the molecular ecology, the biochemical richness of the tropical forest exceeds anything else by many factors. It's so chemically rich there, it's unbelievable. compared to anywhere else.
What is it? Okay? Almost 100% of our antibiotics are come from the rainforest. I mean, this is basically everything to heal ourselves, every food. It's basically where it comes from.
Yeah, super, super rich chemically, okay? Massive chemical profile. And then, as I say, we had this relationship with the forest where we ingesting the chemistry of the forest packaged up in a way that was unusual in that it wasn't, most stuff doesn't want to be eaten, okay? The plants package this stuff up for us. They wanted the damn stuff to be eaten. It's here, have this wonderful biochemically rich food and take the seeds away. That's the basic idea anyway. And when you look at the chemistry, just a very basic look at the chemistry, and there are obviously people doing this kind of research, and you can find their research online. If our neural system evolved in the forest, okay, so it expanded and evolved in the forest, eating this stuff, this chemical cocktail that's so rich it's hard to describe, and by definition, if that was a process, then that became its operating system. You know, it evolved there for tens of millions of years. So the chemistry it's used to is what it needs to operate. Fairly simple idea. Okay. Then at some point, if for whatever reason, climate change, whatever, the forest disappears. So you have this gargantuan new brain with all sorts of wonderful abilities, but it's designed to run on this incredibly complex chemistry, and the chemistry's gone. All we're left with now is what our own mammalian system can produce. We kind of think that's normal because we've never thought of ourselves as symbiotic organisms. But if our new brain, the neocortex, was designed to run on plant chemistry, because that's what we were flooding it with, and then you look at some of the basic data from people like Catherine Milton, who's an anthropologist with an interest in neural evolution, and she's looked at primate diets and so on, you start looking at the chemistry that's gone missing. And we're talking now about things like, you know, mood modulation, drug use and abuse, the history of plant medicines, all the rest of it. It looks to me like our neural system, certainly the most modern part, has lost a minimum, and I emphasize a minimum, of 95% of the neurochemistry it used to run on. And I'm now talking about the plants we used to ingest every day for millions of years that became integral, as they do in symbiotic organisms. So we're running on 95% less of the chemical complexity than we used to. Well, if that's not going to leave us open to all sorts of dysfunction and substance abuse and God knows what else, I don't know what is, you know. And that's pretty solid data. Again, this isn't my data. Very little of what I talk about is my own data. I'm just trying to cobble stuff together that's already there. And in reality, it's more like 98%. I use 95% because you know what it's like when you're proposing ideas. If you're off by 1%, somebody will come along and say, oh, it's 94%. Your whole theory is rubbish. But in reality, even what we consider a moderately healthy diet today, it's 98% missing in terms of chemical complexity. These colossal range of chemicals that the plants produce, the tropical flowers produce, and we see it in the color. It's part of the coloration of flowers, which is part of the plant sex organ. It's in fruit. It's what colored fruit. One of the classes of compounds that I talk about, lots of compounds called flavonoids. They are slowly making their way into more general awareness, but there's hundreds, if not thousands, of them. And they have wonderful properties, like they're powerful antioxidants, so they protect a big brain. If you're going to grow a big brain, it's a headache, because how are you going to protect it? Particularly out in the savannah where there's nothing to build it, there's no chemistry to run it, and it's going to be attacked by and all sorts of stuff. Doesn't matter if you're living in a bath of antioxidants all the time. Doesn't matter anymore. Those same chemicals, in addition to being antioxidants, they're also, certain classes of them are also neuroactive. There's some of the chemicals we might think of today in terms of plant medicines, but they are neuroactive. The monoamine oxidase inhibitors, they elevate neural function. So we're getting a lot of our neurochemistry from the forest. All gone. So we've got a 98% deficit in neurochemistry. And then one of the coolest things about these chemicals, which I haven't really touched on yet because it's such a, you know, is they modulate our own hormones. Particularly, I'm guessing most people will have heard of the sex steroids like testosterone and estrogen. In mammals, they play a massive role in our development. Very important, always have been, always will be. And they play a massive role in the structure and development of our brain. But one of the things they do is the they regulate maturity. They sort of regulate when you become sexually mature and breed, and it's a kind of classic sort of loop in mammals. You know, you get to maturity, you breed quickly. That's one way of surviving. Well, in the deep forest, where there aren't many predators because you don't have the big herds and you don't have the big cats and so on, you have an opportunity there where if your hormones are being modulated by the plants, are being changed basically, and it's allowing you a longer juvenile period to grow a larger and more juvenile brain, that starts to answer a lot of the mysteries around human origins very, very easily. But if you lose that, then you're losing all the protection, all the antioxidants, you're losing all the neurochemistry, so it's just not going to work. And you're losing these hormones that initiated this process, that kept our maturation, the time at which we matured in check. So we ended up maturing much later and not as much at all. I think we stayed in this more juvenile form. It didn't mean we didn't grow physically, but in terms of our general physiology and particular brain, if all that was underpinned by the forest, and the forest disappeared, then oh my God, we're going to be in trouble. And that, I think, is the origins of these ancient mythologies, where, you know, they talk about naked dwelling. It must have been warm, forest dwelling in the forest. So, you know, the parallel stories with modern science, we were forest dwelling apes. Well, the ancient traditions correlate with that, and we had a special relationship with the trees. I'd go as far as saying, really, and I'm, you know, making leaps here, really, it wasn't a mammalian system that grew this phenomenally unusual consciousness system. It was engineered by the plants. The plants had the chemical know-how how to build a consciousness system like this, to grow it, to run it, and we became an integral part of the forest. You know, we were almost wired into the forest. All right, spatially we weren't, but chemically we were. Forest disappears, and then suddenly all we've got is our own mammalian genome, our own mammalian DNA. What does it do? It builds a mammalian brain that likes to mature quite quickly, breed quite quickly, not too bright, quite aggressive, blah, 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 blah. Well, that's what we're turning back into as we mature, paradoxically enough. And I think that's what we're stuck in. We're at the wrong end of that journey. And I think we're on the brink of losing sight of even being able to, you know, see this. Thankfully, we still can. And we still, you know, throughout recorded history and even today, there's still reports of people getting glimpses of that other state. And the fact we can, I think, is hopeful. There is still some wiring there. And I think, if, you know, if we can make the case that we have latent functions, latent cognitive ability, and there's good evidence for that, and we know enough about how to rewire ourselves to get a little bit of that back, then even if that's not the whole solution, it's surely going to equip us with the tools to make the next step. And that's all I'm really arguing for. Is it worth talking about our current neural configuration? Is it serving as well? I don't think so. Are there neural configurations out there that we could adopt in the meantime that are less dangerous, more empathic, more compassionate, more cognitively advanced? You know, I mean, I'm sure you've heard people are now microdosing with LSD in all sorts of jobs because it's enhancing their cognition. It's a very limited approach, and it's probably enhancing their cognition to do something bloody useless, but never mind. The principle is there. I think all that's on offer today, right now. We could, with a little bit of preparation, move ourselves from hell-bent on self-destruction, creating hell on earth, to taking a step back towards something more functional. And we could do that. We could do that yesterday. Whether we choose to do that or even ask these questions, I don't know.
You know, speaking of, you know, as you talked about sleep deprivation, et cetera, on Joe Rogan's podcast, he talked about his writers on his TV show would purposefully stay up till 2-3 o'clock in the morning on purpose and wouldn't write a thing until everybody was exhausted at about 4 a.m., 5 a.m., and then they would write. And this was a hit show that lasted forever, had some good writing on it. And you talked about the hormones for a while, the hormone influence. And now people generally only know the one or two, but there's, what, 50 or so different hormone levels of interaction that happen in your body. And, you know, Dr. Mark Gordon, actually, I want to say Mark L. Gordon, actually, He's done a lot of work with people with mental illness, particular PTSD, severe depression, addiction, etc. And he goes, takes a direct hormonal approach and has amazing results that outdo anything else that's symptom related, treating symptoms only, right? And so that hormonal approach is amazingly making changes in the psychology world. And it's proven so much to be influential. And in when we have children, what age our children are, how old we are when we reproduce, etc. You know, you talked about feeling connected. You know, I was raised in doing a lot of things in nature, being connected and hunting for one of them, but et cetera. But when you're out there or you're just being in it, you do feel a part of it. You can hear anything. It's almost like all your senses just zoom to the top, right? You're connected. And, you know, how would you approach the idea that we naturally left, you know, the forest or the trees or the beach or the ocean, we left those to build cities. And so we could claim that the cities that we built are natural. You know, they're natural because we're a species, we made it, that's our home, the same way that a beaver would build their home somewhere that's not natural, where we live is natural.
Well, I suppose I wouldn't call it unnatural. I don't think anything we've done is unnatural. I think, you know, you start having to reinvent the term natural. I think it's whether it's remotely sane or not is more appropriate, and whether we chose to do that or whether we've ended up reacting to our environment all the while that our neural system has been degenerating. And I think, again, it's the opposite of a lot of current thinking, but if our potential intelligence, and clearly we do have that potential, I think, was born out of this relationship in the forest and modulated and created by the forest chemistry. So if the forest disappeared or whatever happened, and there's evidence that certainly could have happened in Africa at least, we end up in a situation where you have to survive. We had the intelligence to survive, but that didn't necessarily give us solutions to losing the most complex ecosystem there ever has been. You know, I think we'd be hard push to do that today. If the tropical forest disappeared, which is a risk it's, you know, it's going to do, how do we reinvent that complexity? So I think we had the intelligence to survive in all sorts of conditions, clearly. But all the while our function was declining. And that's the one thing we've not been able to solve, I think, because by the time I think we recognized the problem, it was already too late. We're in this cycle of degeneration, and we've ended up, particularly in the last 5,000-10,000 years, and certainly the last 1,000 to 2,000 years, almost completely losing sight of that. Certainly our culture has, that these were important questions. We've now just turned 180 degrees, and we're obsessed with this idea of rational logic, advanced cities, whatever. Totally the wrong direction altogether, but we're completely blind to it now. Again, it's that dementia analogy, whereas we still know of peoples today and a lot that we've destroyed in the last 400-500 years who had a very different approach. Their priority was to stay connected as best they could, all the while accepting that there were problems and accepting. Their ancestors were in culture to keep the door open as much as possible. And that, not intentionally, I think, just because it, again, is a symptom of mental ill health. That's what we've done. So I don't think anything that we've done is unnatural. It's more a symptom of a severe and ongoing neurological problem. That's all. Of course, that encompasses a vast amount. But, you know, when you look at our history, particularly Western culture and what we're doing now, I think that's a much easier fit than trying to explain it in all sorts of convoluted ideas of advanced culture and so on. It's just a symptom of insanity. And as I said earlier, even the bits of technology that we could perhaps make use of, for the most part, they're turned against ourselves, either to destroy each other or destroy the place we live, and certainly not to enhance our state of mind in any other way then can be used to further that cause. You know, the idea that we can enhance our state of mind and lose interest in our self-destructive nature is seen as highly dangerous. You know, the kind of classic idea of, you know, tune in, drop out, whatever, that kind of stuff of the 60s. I'd much rather live in an environment like that, where we still got a lot of problems to solve, but at least we're not interested anymore in building cities and destroying ourselves. But that's not acceptable. It, you know, we've got, there's so much pressure to get involved in the societal structures that are, we know damn fine, are destroying ourselves. And that's, that, that's the sort of core of our culture. So is unnatural, I don't know, but insane, I can't find another way to see it anymore.
I couldn't say it better. I mean, the insanity is definitely it. And if the denial is so strong that a species-wide personality disorder exists, that our cognitive dissonance and denial is so strong that we continue to operate as we do, you know, we all know in counseling, psychology, etc., that someone with a personality disorder is the least likely to seek help, is the least likely to come for help because, well, it's not me, it's the rest of the fucking world.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this time, if as a species, we are all narcissist personality disorder and it's in our brain functioning and we are not aware of that, but yet in denial of it, and we continue to say, it's not me, it's the rest of the world. Well, yeah, you're fucking right. And it starts with really ourselves, with being aware of ourselves, of our own actions and what we decide to, I guess, decide is supposed to is, or what we should do based on what's been given to us or told to us. Right. I mean, it seems like it starts with questioning self again and not, you know, I don't know. The only tool I know in psychology for a narcissist is being aware you're a narcissist, and good luck. Right. And it feels like that's like the road that we're on as a species. We're a total narcissist, not willing to even question our own advancement.
Well, I agree to a significant point, but I think there's a couple of things I think that are potentially hopeful. First of all, I see this condition, or however you want to describe it, it has a spectrum of severity and symptoms. And I think because it's hormonally related, and I haven't gone into all the detail, and won't be time to do all that. Obviously, there's resources for that. But in a very general way, males are more susceptible to being hit hardest. It's not right across the board, but I'm, you know, I am generalizing here, particularly older males, again, because of the effects of testosterone. But, you know, females aren't immune from this at all. And then you wind back towards youth and that juvenile period, less affected. So there is a spectrum. And you can see that in the emergence of patriarchy. I mean, I consider the emergence of patriarchal systems as an early symptom of this condition. Because as males, or as a percentage of males, became more afflicted, more frightened, more sociopathic, and their need for control became unbearable, they ended up in control. And we got used to that system. We kind of think it's normal now. But it's you know, if it's a symptom of neurological dysfunction, and if there's a spectrum of the severity, the further up the hierarchy you go, with the exception of people who are just phenomenally good at stuff, so that's why they're in that position. But I'm generally talking about people who want to be in control and control things.
Right.
And we all, you know, we facilitate that because we've bought into that. We bought into the idea that we need a hierarchy and a bunch of people telling us what to do. But if we can make a rational case based on the very kind of science and language that spectrum has some respect for, so modern Western science, for all its failings, is still a very dominant force. So if it's possible, and I'm saying if it's possible to make a case that there is a species-wide disorder and it afflicts people the further up that hierarchy they go, not because it's their fault, they just happen to have the condition more than average. So if that case can be made and widely disseminated, then one thing that I have some hope about is that the condition brings with it lots of traits, and, you know, we've touched on a lot of them, and there is delusion and denial and psychopathy and control and fear, all that kind of stuff. But one of the things that I've noticed, and we probably all notice in ourselves if we're honest, is that kind of egotistical mind, which is the same description, I think, is one of the things that controls it more than almost anything else, is it likes to be seen to be clever. Really doesn't want to be seen to be the stupid one in the room. And I'd like to think there's a way of presenting this Trojan horse-like, in that you sort of unfold the diagnosis, there's no blame, and the really smart, intelligent, cool thing is to accept the diagnosis. That's what the really intelligent people are seeing. And almost pull that kind of egotistical mind, secretly screaming, but not wanting to be seen to be stupid, not wanting to be the last one to jump ship under the idea that, yeah, we've all got a problem, we can solve this and end up in a much better place. And I think that might be a way around a percentage of people who are trapped in that control and sort of psychopathy that are disproportionately influential, because numbers-wise, it's not a huge amount of people, but the influence is massive because they're in positions of control. In fact, I think the spectrum works along those lines. I think the vast majority of people are open to these ideas. They might not have come across them. They might not have all the background science to understand all the detail, but the idea that there's something seriously wrong, I get a lot of immediate reaction of, well, yeah, obviously, you know, that's kind of the response from most people I meet. The kind of defensive denial from a much, much smaller percentage of people. But obviously they're very important people because they tend to be in people and in positions of influence. But that's what I've noticed. I think the idea that if there's any validity to this, and it can be packaged up in such a way that it's clear, accessible, and it's really explaining who and what we are from a kind of perspective of a dysfunctional disorder, and the really smart people see this soonest, that puts an awful lot of pressure on the egotistical mind. You know, I've seen people who maybe have some of those characteristics and are initially uncomfortable, but in a group of people who go, oh, yeah, I can see that. I've seen this all my life. It's, you know, I've always known there's something wrong. They'll jump ship because they don't want to be the us in the room that looks stupid. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, tons. One, I'll start out by first claiming I'm the dumb guy in the room right now.
Well, hey, listen, I include myself in that. I wasn't, you know, it's just a general way of describing things.
I know. No, I'm pointing that as the first place to start with the awareness, right? That has to begin of understanding that we don't know. Look, and there's tons of research out there from a business standpoint included, that those that are running business that succeed at certain competitions do have a level and would test for a level of a personality disorder. I mean, I got the privilege, I won't mention a company name, but a very, very successful giant company that has their hands in a lot of things, their salesperson hiring test. And it's purposefully skewed to find the narcissist slash risk taker who typically you wouldn't hire. They go for hiring for salespeople. Almost as like, we need that. So, look at who we just voted as a leader. I mean, look at the perfect person for a leader is the person that thinks they shouldn't be a leader, in my opinion. But everyone leading is someone that thinks they should be leading, right? We are caught in that paradox.
Yeah. And we've known this for a long time. But I think if it's framed within, on the one hand, it's all arbitrary language, we forget this. But, you know, Western science disciplines, it's a very powerful language in our culture. It's seen as real, or as real as anything can get. So if you can frame that awareness that we've already had for a long time, but if it's locked into a neurological explanation, it's not a philosophical explanation, it's not anything too esoteric, it's about harsh terms again, it's about brain dysfunction, etc., etc. If we can tie these things together and make it so uncomfortable to not look at this and to not accept this, because the other thing I've observed, and again, I'm sure I'm not the first person to observe this, but a lot of people with those traits, you know, it's like they're having to run really fast to stay still. It is driven by fear. It might be very well disguised, very, very well hidden. But I'd like to think, and I might be overly optimistic here, there's a lot of people in those positions, if they could, with some dignity, let go of the steering wheel, they would. Because it's actually a very stressful thing to constantly stay in control. If there was another option presented, that relieved any blame. And it's like, here's a much better way. You know, here's an approach where you're just going to feel great and you won't want to do anything, you know. But that's the very opposite of what we're told we should be doing, because, of course, it's all tainted with this increasingly sociopathic drive to be in control. And we've been encouraged to do that. You know, it's there from very early on in our culture, in our schools, competition, competition, competition. Symbiosis is the opposite of that. It was the most cooperative form of evolution you could imagine. And if that's our origin, then what we're doing now is so alien, or it's winding the clock back so far back to when we were, again, pretty dumb mammals running around on the forest floor before we made this connection with fruit and the trees. So I think there may be ways forward in principle. If there is that kind of problem, I think it could be presented in such a way that that almost be mass relief. It's like, thank God, you know, I've noticed this individually. It's, oh my God, thank God I understand this now. At least there's a way out, and I don't have to feel guilty, and I don't have to demonize myself. It's not a license to just behave like an idiot. It's actually, it's like, it's a way out of the prison and to start proactively changing things. And I think even a lot of people with those psychometric tests that are built into corporate hiring now, which I understand and I've heard of, even people that far up the ladder, I think somewhere deep inside, unless they're extreme psychopaths, would probably like to get off the merry-go-round and have a nicer time if they could do it in such a way that it was socially acceptable. At the minute, it's not allowed. But that's another symptom of our collective madness.
A collective madness. It does. It's hard to ignore. I feel like that's really where we're headed, Tony. We could do this for hours, man. I mean,
well, I think to just qualify that, I think have a lot of choice in this. We can choose more of the same. All right, there are political structures and societal structures, but they're all made up of people, and it's still people making decisions. You know, we can choose more of this direction, or we can choose some radical alternatives, and that is up to us. And if we choose to go over the cliff, we've got nobody but ourselves to blame at the end of the day. So, you know, on the one hand, it's tough. On the other hand, at some level, certainly in our culture, we all participate in the status quo. You know, we might post stuff on Facebook or make some comments down the pub, but then we all join in with the dance and we don't make too many waves because it's societally unacceptable. Well, if that's a level of our resistance to this condition, then, you know, we have had it. But if we're willing to say no, enough, we really need to make some other choices here. I think that is an option. We've done it in the past for, you know, maybe not such major issues, but clearly when we have had enough, we can make changes. And I'd like to think there's still time to do that, even though things are pretty dire. You know, I don't think we're quite out of time yet, but the clock is ticking.
I think hope is a strong word that, you know, you almost have to hold close. You mentioned something that it's funny. I say a lot on my podcast the last couple of weeks is I noticed that people are obsessed with being in a hurry to do nothing, obsessed within a hurry to sit still, to do nothing. We're in a hurry to get in the car to take a road trip. We're in a hurry to get to the airport to sit on a plane for 16 hours. We're in a hurry to get home and sit on the couch for 8 hours. We're in a hurry to get in bed and sleep for two. We're in this incessant hurry to do nothing.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of traits that are highly suspicious at best and quite dysfunctional at worst. But I think one of the things that I find interesting is a progression of sort of digital technology and virtual, you know, sort of holographic equipment and so on. And, you know, obviously there's been some progress in the last 10, 20 years. And yet the irony is, this thing we have between our ears, we all have the most advanced thing we could ever imagine between our ears. And yet look how we treat it, what we build it from, what we fuel it from, what we do with it. And the evidence is pretty consistent throughout history and currently that if you get this thing working a little bit, and I emphasize a little bit, through whatever approaches or whatever combination of approaches, it totally shits all over all of our technology combined in terms of how engaging it is, how phenomenal it is, what you can do with it, and how immediately disinteresting absolutely everything that our left brain cultures provided becomes. And again, that is accessible. You know, we can choose to keep starving it of necessary chemistry, building it from the most damaged construction materials and locking ourselves into mundane self-destructive patterns, or we can start turning some of the lights on and be completely blown away for the whole of our lives, individually and collectively, or not, you know. And again, those choices already exist. So, you know, I think there is hope there, but we're going to have to start making those choices, and instead of endlessly running on the wheel and never getting off, you know, we can choose to get off, turn the lights on a little bit, and spend the rest of our days in awe and wonder, and also be functional enough to meet our needs, because those two things can go hand in hand. I think there's a, you know, there's a sort of propaganda element to, oh, well, how on earth would we, you know, how on earth would we get from day to day? Well, I suspect that we had a much more functional state of mind that wasn't only perceptual, wasn't about our consciousness system, but it was, you know, in that kind of Zen tradition where, or the origins of martial arts and whatever, where they were really training the mind, much less the body. And once you've mastered that, everything worked better, not just cognitive function, not just perceptual awareness, but we had more stamina, we had more strength, we had more of everything, because our management system was no longer severely dysfunctional and we were capable of anything. I'm not saying we choose to do the same things. I very much doubt we'd build cities in the way we've done, or build stealth bombers or nuclear weapons, because I have a suspicion that would not be on our agenda. But I suspect we could run with our technology and develop a technology to enhance our existence in a way that was very sustainable and functional. And, you know, that's the kind of world I think we could create. But at the minute, we're choosing not to do that.
You see a move to this transpersonal life, right? This giving up of this human life, if you will, and moving to this immersion of technology, this immortality almost, if you will, this chasing immortality, almost as if, yeah, we know that eating healthy and eating properly or whatever you want to call it and being in nature is good for you, and vitamin D is good for you. Dr. Rhonda Patrick's work on our gut and what we eat and how it treats our brain. We know all that, that's sure, but you know what? Let's just keep moving forward. And rather, we've come so far, let's just drop the whole human body thing altogether and just go to tech. Now, you know what I mean? It's almost like this. Let's just keep riding the damn rails.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I find it very sad. And, you know, again, it's just a projection of the left brain seeing a future for itself. And that's almost digitizing itself, because somehow that's shiny and advanced. And it's the exact opposite. You know, a single cell of any species, a plant cell, a neural cell, is beyond most of our wildest imaginations as to how complex it is. And it's made out of stuff that we don't even know what it is. You know, we've got nice labels when you get all the way down, but then it sort of becomes a bit esoteric in description in the weird end of physics. And somehow it works. And there's tens of billions of these things work together, and they produce phenomenal experience. And yet as you say, a percentage of people are being drawn to this kind of sterile, digitized version, when we haven't begun, at least in recent times, to experience what the much more complex version is, which is, you know, the biology, the neurology. Get that fired up, even partially, and that will make a mockery of the best that we could possibly imagine technological-wise. You know, biology's what we call biology, this process, this cosmological process, it's resulted in this equipment. Even though I think it's in deep trouble, it still makes our wildest dreams of technology look pathetic. And yet we choose not to repair it. We choose not to engage it. We choose, you know, what's the equivalent of a junior chemistry set compared to the tropical forest? And again, you know, what direction this will go in, who knows? But we do have those choices, and it's very worrying that we're sucked in more and more to the, you know, the digitized version of ourselves, as if somehow that's going to be better. The ancients and even tribal people today, there seems to still be the relics of this idea that our sense of who and what we are, which I think is heavily distorted and limited now, but there's certainly endless accounts and current accounts of reawakening into our body and it's a different sensation altogether, but it's a profound, wondrous experience. It's beyond a privilege almost. That's what people report in those states, and you could never tire of how amazing it feels. It's so all encompassing and wonderful. That's already on offer, and yet we pursue these dreams of plastic versions of ourselves.
Yeah, you've said it once or twice here that this left side of the brain is able to lie to itself, that it's able to convince itself of what it has to do, what it should do. And, you know, you mentioned about it even affecting males harder. Well, let's look back at every leader, general, every round table. Let's look at every picture down the CEO hall of, say, I don't know, Publix. Let's see what those pictures look like, right? I mean, we see that, you know, almost who is willing to be that narcissist, that ruthless at times, is who we allow to make it to the top, as if we're still monkeys going, all right, he hits everyone harder and that wolf beats up everyone, so fuck it, we'll follow that one. I don't want any confrontation.
Well, I think that's part of the irony of this condition. If there's any validity to this, then I think the way our neural system has gone since the end of this symbiosis, it's maturing one side more quickly than the other. And I think that leaves the door open to two things. As our left brain's matured more, it's lost its plasticity, it's lost all these unusual and rare traits, and it's reverted to this more, or it's increasingly reverting to this more typical mammalian form, which is hierarchical, but in the sense that it's susceptible to either wanting to be in control or wanting to be controlled. Like, you know, we almost want a pecking order, we almost want that structure. But that in itself is a symptom of severe dysfunction, but it's opened the door to exactly what's happened. The worst case scenario, people end up in charge. And for the most part, we almost, I'm not saying everybody all the time, but we kind of crave some of that structure because that's what our rational mind now recognizes as necessary and real, like what you see in packs of animals and so on. You know, that's what we're reverting back to. So it's kind of worked both ends of the spectrum. It's facilitated the emergence of those extremely psychopathic or much more primitive minds. And it's made us all susceptible to wanting that form of control to some degree as well. And again, we need to recognize that. We need to recognize that that's what we've become. And that's the very opposite, I think, of our ancestors, where we were, you know, connected not just in an abstract sense or a philosophical sense, but we saw ourselves as the same being almost, absolutely equal and yet profound at the same time. And we still get glimpses of that, and people do report that. So again, I think the wiring is still there to some degree to support that, but not in our normal state of mind. Quite obviously, the idea that the left hemisphere has any of those capacities is a joke, because we'd experience them. We don't. They don't emerge unless you approach some, you know, use some techniques or treatments, or occasionally spontaneously something will happen, or it's in a lucid dream or a dreamlike state. But in a day-to-day state, that's incredibly rare. So it doesn't exist there. It must exist somewhere else. And once you start tapping into it, that need to be in control disappears. In fact, one of the things people report a lot from these states is, well, the fear just went away. And I'm talking about the fear we probably all feel but don't want to talk about, that kind of background paranoia that, you know, we all know the rules and we all say the right things and we don't want to be, you know, pointed out for the most part. We find that too intimidating, too frightening. Well, that goes away. There's no conscious sort of self-consciousness in that sense. And equally, the idea that other people would be in charge and there'd be this hierarchy becomes a joke. It's not a concept anymore. It's an experience. So there's no wonder, I think, that our left brain society has done everything it can to marginalize and prevent approaches that can open that door, because it's too threatening. You know, I'm talking even about dance, music, anything to do with pleasure, because extreme pleasure is the right hemisphere. The sense of control and the sense of contentment where there's no immediate fear, that contrived control, and that sense of anticipation when you're going to go to the shops and buy some more junk you don't need, that's left hemisphere. That's kind of left hemisphere having a good time. Profound divine joy isn't left hemisphere at all. So if you're going to access that, which a lot of the traditions were about, it means you have to, you know, you have to come up with an approach that takes you out of your left hemisphere. Well, that's a massive threat. See, you can see throughout history and currently how any approach that can partially create that is immediately taboo. It's legislated against, and still is today. You know, we've created a society where the very last relics of things that could help turn this around have been prohibited. You know, it's more acceptable to, you know, classic stuff, I suppose, watch 100 people be murdered on TV by the time you're 10 or whatever, than as an adult changing your own consciousness in a direction that makes you feel better and interact better. That's prohibited, the other one's not. You know, it's layer upon layer of evidence that we're in a lot more trouble than I think we can realize.
So rather than a prediction of any kind, what I'd like to hear to close out, you know, this one of hopefully many more rampages, in your hope filter, what do you hope happens? And I don't need a 20-year, 30-year, I don't need a ballpark, but rather than we can look at evidence and make a cynical observation, right? Or we can choose a bias or a optimistic one. So from what is the hope filter of the future of the human species and our brain dysfunction and hopeful functioning? What's that story for you?
Well, obviously it's very colored by the last 20 years, but in some ways, I hope there is a serious neurological condition. I'm quite invested in that now, and I totally hold my hands up. But I think there's a lot of evidence to support that. As I said earlier, if there's not a problem, then in some ways I'm a lot more pessimistic. But if there is a problem, then I hope it's possible to communicate that problem in a more accessible way than I've managed so far. But I think it's possible. I'm working on some projects now. And where I'm really hopeful is if this really comes down to a significant change in our neural development and our neurochemistry, that can be reversed, that can be changed. Some of it quite quickly. Some of it we can change almost immediately, or certainly within a lifetime with a bit of careful preparation. And it's almost formulaic, never mind all the mysterious sort of traditions and mystery schools and this and that and the other. We haven't got time for that. We don't understand that anymore. So looking at it in modern neurological terms, as I said earlier, we have the capacity to retrofit some of the complex and colossal amount of missing biochemistry, and then we can work with techniques that inhibit the damage or the, you know, the more dysfunctional part of our brain and engage the more functional part of our brain. That's not rocket science. That's a really simple formula, and I challenge anybody to sort of use that template to place over any of the ancient traditions and their practices and do those things more or less fit. And I would say for the most part they do. Well, we can all choose to do that today, you know, start on that process. And then beyond that, because this, I see this as primarily a developmental problem. It's not a genetic change, not significant. It's not that genetics haven't changed a little bit over the last 50, 100, 200,000 years or whatever, but this is a developmental change. This is about the hormonal regime. It kind of comes under modern epigenetics and, you know, how you read the DNA, not what the DNA actually says. And through a relatively small number of generations, this could be changed. We could recreate the environment that grew as this colossal, pretty unique consciousness system, perceptual equipment, whatever you want to call it, that worked in a radically different way. We could recreate those conditions. And it's really just creating conditions that read basic mammalian DNA very differently. Basically keeping us in a juvenile state, letting us grow this colossal juvenile brain with all those traits and probably traits that we've lost because our brain shrunk a lot in the last, you know, several tens of thousands of years. That can all be achieved, I think, quite quickly. So in a lifetime, almost overnight, in terms of the time it's taken to get to this state, we can start glimpsing those things. And I think if it's done safely and done in the kind of traditional approach, you know, sort of there's still traditions exist where there's apprenticeships and people learn how to do these things, we can all get glimpses sufficient, the kind of life-changing experience that people report on a daily basis that will change our direction for the rest of our lives. It doesn't necessarily mean we can stay in those states. That's a bit more tricky. I think it can be worked on, but we can regularly visit that state, and that can inform us for the rest of the time where we want to be going. And a lot of people have that experience, you know, where they've had even quite advanced sociopaths have had life-changing experiences where they effectively drop their identity, drop all the crazy stuff they were doing. It's like, okay, I'm not interested in that anymore. I'm going to dedicate my life to furthering this. Or, you know, I think there's a formula that we can start applying almost immediately and start moving in that direction. So that's my hope. But I think that's not going to come about until, A, we recognize how serious the problem is, as you pointed out before. Is it a problem in our neural system? I think the case is there to be made, and I welcome debate. In fact, I'd invite anybody to take on that idea, try and make it work, and then see if it's, you know, see if it holds water. And, you know, then we start applying practical approaches. And, you know, we've got ourselves into this mess inadvertently. We can dig ourselves out, and we already know a lot. We already know a lot. You know, tradition people have kept alive some of these practices. We've started incorporating some of them into our mad culture. You start combining them, you start understanding the problem, and you start treating it. And the results can be both rapid and quite literally profound in relatively short periods of time. Enough that, you know, once you get a glimpse of that, the rest of the stuff we're doing, it's not only pointless, you know how self-destructive it is. You wouldn't go near it with a barge pole if you could help it. Why would you want to get involved in creating hell on earth when you can turn 180 degrees and start moving towards creating a society that's based on all those traits that we like to think are human but are actually becoming increasingly rare? Empathy, compassion, feeling bloody amazing, connected with nature. Why wouldn't we want that?
And that's a cognitive rampage right there. All right, Tony. Thank you for coming on. Where can everyone look up your work? Can they find you? What's the website? We put a lot of research. We quote a lot of people here throughout the show. So there's a lot of homework for people to do, and myself as well, as I learn more. But where can they find you directly?
Well, I'd say it's a work in progress. I've still got a lot to do with this. But there is a book that outlined the basic theory. It was mostly written about 10, 15 years ago. I think it's a good introduction. It was originally published as Left in the Dark, but it was republished as Return to the Brain of Eden. So there's a good introduction there. And then I've fought my own fears and Asperger traits and done, you know, more public speaking over the last few years. I think the early stuff, well, hopefully it's got better as time has gone on. So I've got a fair bit of stuff on YouTube. I think the YouTube channel is Tony Wright UK, and a few articles and bits and pieces. But yeah, if you just do a search, use my name and either Left in the Dark or Return to the Brain of Eden, or find the YouTube channel. And between all the different formats, I think there's enough information there to piece together the picture. And then, of course, I would say this isn't up to me. This is up to anybody who's interested in what on earth's going on. You know, to run with this, find the holes in it, fill the gaps in, and do something with it. Because if we have got a species-wide problem, nobody on their own can fix this. You know, this would have to be a collective effort. So, you know, there's the invitation or the challenge.
A collective awakening, and a collective awareness, which I personally believe can only start if each individual personally is willing to question themselves. If, as an individual, we're at least willing to question our own functioning, our own thoughts, our own behaviors, look at our own desires objectively, really step back and have the willingness to question, you know, our species as a whole, right? And even some obvious things we see, I think, you know, we can make that change. And, you know, to try to maybe help, you know, to bring people to what may be happening here is, in the most simplistic terms, that I have to dumb it down because I'm a dummy. So, I mean, for those of you out there that are like me, it would be that we have a crisis going on, as we call it evolution, but we are really devolving. We are not even noticing the destruction of our own species that we're making, nor do we care and we call it something else, and no one's willing to take a look at it, and no one's really looking at the fact outside of we are the greatest species, we were put here to dominate, we're smart, we have evolved, we've lasted, here's 17,000 other species that didn't, we've grown, and this narcissist march forward. If we could pause for a moment, practice some humility, and take an inner look backwards, we may actually be able to change what could be a cycle of our own humanity since we've been birthed really to be man or woman.
Yeah. Again, that's the hopeful part of this. I think if there is the problem, as I've outlined, a neurological condition, we could make rapid changes and move towards significant solutions within a very short time. And that is exciting. And there's already evidence for that. You know, we can make massive changes to our neural configuration and get really good results. So it's just a case of rolling out what we already know as a starting point. And, a lot of those other symptoms go away. We wouldn't be hell-bent on self-destruction if we were even partly sane. So I am hopeful. I think it is possible. But as you say, we do need to make that choice. And that is probably the trickiest bit of all.
It is. And questioning the things we believe. You know, it's hard not to walk through all this and not look at the basic, you know, foundations of many religions and even their metaphoric stories or literal stories or whatever, and not kind of see like, shit, it's kind of like what they're saying is like, if unless there's this awakening, we're going to end in fire and brimstone here. Like, you know what I mean? Or at some place, unless something happens, we go to a shit place. And now, these are the cliff notes of many monotheist type religions here. I get it. But yep. If we do are able to step back and see that and say, wow, maybe it's just a bunch of different tries of trying to reiterate if this awakening does not happen, sure, destruction awaits us.
Yeah, I completely agree. And it is very worrying and very scary. But the flip side of that is, you know, I think we can make that choice, certainly in principle, and see rapid results, and, you know, literally take charge of our destiny rather than being victims, decide that we want something vastly better. And I think what I've outlined is at least a mechanism that could explain why we were once in a very different state. You know, I think there's a lot of skepticism. Oh, well, you know, such a state never existed. Well, I think the idea of this unique relationship and this unique chemistry at least offers a possibility that state once did exist, and therefore, by definition, we should be able to recreate it. And at the very least, I'd say it's worth exploring. If it's not the case, if we're stuck with what we've got, I don't know. You know, maybe somebody else can come up with something. But at the very least, surely, with what's going on, it's worth exploring with an open mind rather than a skeptical mind. In the tradition of debating societies, you know, take it on board and try and make it fit before you then try and break it see how it stacks up.
Yeah, you're kind. It's worth to be explored. No, let me rephrase that for you, Tony. Hey, your kid's life and their kid's life and humanity may fucking depend on this shit. So, it's worth to be explored, all right? I don't have to be accepted by the academics and all these other people, man. So, in a cognitive rampage format, yeah, it's worth exploring. Yeah.
I hope so.
Man, our evolution depends on it, man. Holy shit, Tony. You're nice, man.
Well, you know, thanks for the invite, and I hope it made some sense. I know I have a habit of rambling on, but I guess the title of the show gave me a little bit of leeway, so.
I mean, come on. I am... probably, I don't know about the king of the cognitive rampage anymore, Tony. My God. But at least the forget part and the squirreling off part, that part I can definitely still remain the king of. But will you come back on sometime next year? And it sounds funny, even though it's only a couple weeks away. But
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. I'm happy to sort of update what I'm doing and what's going on. If it inspires people to, again, ask these questions, that's all I'm asking for is, you know, look into this, see if it makes any sense. You know, I'm worried about our future. I have family as well. and I don't see a lot of focus on core solutions. It's just rearranging the furniture as the ship goes down for the most part, and I'm not happy about that. In fact, I'm damn sure I'm not going to stand by and do nothing. So,
oh, you took the words right out of my mouth, man. That's why we tackle a lot of what we do. And frankly, I mean, the Tribe of Change is a group, I think, dedicated to looking in those things, trying it out and asking those questions and see. And I think, you know, the epitome of why I do this show or anything else, honestly, or post anything or whatever and have guests on, is that basic, is to make you think. If at least we can make you think and put a question mark at the end of the dialogue rather than periods, well, then perhaps we can grow as a species. So if anything, I'm with you. If it does the slightest make you think, at least dive into it. I love your idea of try to make it fit before you shoot it down and see what happens.
Well, it's one of the ways I describe it when it comes to this idea of, you know, a serious neurological condition with severe perceptual symptoms. I feel my role, my minimum objective at least, is to create, kind of in a legal sense, reasonable doubt. If there's reasonable doubt that our only equipment for perception, decision-making, behavior, because that's what it is, you know, every crazy thing going on somewhere stems from somebody's decision. If there's reasonable doubt that that's not functional or that it's seriously dysfunctional, that should be enough to make us stop and think about what we're doing. In the same way that if, you know, I've used this analogy before, for if you're waiting for a plane to fly across the Atlantic and you're in the, you know, in the sort of departure lounge, and there's a rumor goes around that, you know, the maintenance crew dropped the in-flight computer system. But it's fine. They put it back and it's probably okay. You know, you'd be nuts to get on the plane, and the captain wouldn't get on the plane. The pilot wouldn't get on the plane, whatever. Well, I think there's enough reasonable doubt regarding our neural configuration, our neural function, our behavior, that we should be seriously looking at that before we do anything else. Now, I don't know how practical that is, but, you know, I think it's beyond reasonable doubt. I think there's a lot of doubt, and, going on with what we're doing is the surest confirmation, in my opinion, that we're in serious trouble. You know, I think if we stopped and had a good, long, hard look in the mirror and collectively and looked for possible causes, that would show some symptoms of sanity. And we should be doing that anyway, even if it turns out we're sane. We should be checking in regularly. That would be the sane thing to do. But where I think there's all this evidence, historic, current collective behavior, then anybody suggesting more of the same, unfortunately, I think, has the condition worse than average. That's the most delicate way I can put it.
You're kind. I'll say it my way, that if you haven't learned anything from World War One, the Huns, or any other domination of other countries and competitiveness and doing more of the same, if Afghanistan, if none of this has taught you anything, well, you're mentally fucking ill.
Yep. Okay. That's another way of saying it.
Well, I'm allowed to say that kind of stuff, Tony. You keep being the smart guy and I'll keep being the guy that just kicks in the front door, right?
Yeah.
Hey, I appreciate you coming on, man. And by the way, your books are all linked to this live link. They'll be linked. We're going to post the podcast probably in maybe an hour or so. This is already live on YouTube. So all the links to your books will be easily accessible to find. So, Tony, thank you very much, my friend, for coming on and sharing this with me.
Okay. Well, thanks again. And as I say, there is other material. It's fairly easy to find. Obviously, it's difficult to create a complete picture in a one-off interview or discussion. So, you know, I'd suggest the gaps can be filled in, whether it's the book or other YouTube videos or whatever. So please do that. And yeah, thanks again for having me on. And I'm sure we'll speak again sometime.
Yeah. And any questions, if people have them, send them to me. Send them to Tony if you want to be bothered like that. And as we build up maybe a list of questions, or also consider, Tony, anytime you have something you want to talk about, just give me a shout. Give me an email. Give me a heads up, man. We'll come on and talk about something new or something maybe you just want to get off your chest. Yeah.
Okay. That's great. Thanks very much.
All right, man. Thanks again, bud.
All right. Bye.
Well, holy shit. To take a shit, and I kept going, reconnected it all, jumped back up. But we go almost 3 hours on a podcast and nothing. And right at the end, before I'm going on a rant, I'm going to take that as a sign that I'm done. But just approach it by seeing, trying to make it fit first, right? Apply your research bias, if you will, first as you think about it. Look at us as a whole. What we do, what our choices are, what we can, not the idea of luxury or air condition or fucking right food, right? Having to kill your own food, which some people actually prefer, right? It's more organic. Or the idea of you could be killed or diseases that could take you out. I get it, you know, but just everything we talked about, really, just take an objective look at all that process. That's a rabbit hole I've been down for 3 days. So I'm going to keep running down it for the next couple of days. Next week, on the show, Naughty, my boy Naughty Aguilar, Functional Patterns, is coming back. We're going to close out the new year, Naughty and I. We got a couple subjects and a couple topics we want to hit. Shout out to all the Functional Patterns family out there, the FP fam, love you guys. Tribe of Change, love you too. I think actually Tony came from a suggestion of the Tribe of Change. We have one Tribe of Change member too coming on, I think next week. I think it's Shane DeLange, I think. But anyway, the new year is coming out good. Got a lot of good names coming in, a lot of new topics. I may take this in a different direction. You've seen us change lanes a few times, right? We have our main threads that we stick to at TCR, but I'm going to talk about that when Naughty comes on. So one of the topics about the new direction, the Cognitive Rampage podcast, is thinking about going in January. But I'm going to ask you all. So when Naughty's on and him and I are going to shoot the shit for a while to close out the year, I'm going to pose the new turn that I'm thinking about taking TCR on and a new focus. And I want to know what you think, honestly. So if you think it'll be a good idea, let me know. All right. But anyway, again, the second edition, Cognitive Rampage, the Cognitive Rampage Revisited, right, will be out January. I'm aiming second week of January. Never know. But coming out in January, you won't be able to buy it like this again. So if you get it now, it's just $10, whatever. But I'm really, 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 really excited about this revision. I'm serious. Like, it's beautiful. Like, oh, I'm telling you. Anyway, that's coming out along with the audiobook in January at the same time. I do read the audiobook, and I read the second edition. I don't read this version. In the audio version, actually, imagine this. I squirrel off a few times, and I left it in there. I left it to where I read something in the book, and I just kind of, you know, I don't squirrel off too long, but it gets a little personal. So it may feel like a podcast once in a while, and then I'll get back on to reading the book as best I could. But yeah, that's the audiobook. And Dollar Mental Health Club, as I said in the beginning, we'll be back in January. We finished the alpha test, got great results. A new design, a new way coming out in January, new offers and new thing. But it's a paradigm shift to mental health. For $1 a minute, man, you get strategies, tools from actually specialized
help her specialize mental trainers, right? It's not therapy. It's not counseling. I'm trying to basically shove it to the fucking insurance companies. That's what we're trying to do. Is they've gotten rich for so many years and forced people into plans and say they offer help. And frankly, they even make, when you have insurance, they even make it a bitch to try to go see somebody for mental health and mazes you got to go through, copays, deductibles. It's fucking insane. And there's a giant group out there that just can't get the help affordable. So the idea is trying to bring the solution focused help in mental health, not therapy and regression and diagnosis, but tools. It's like strategies, right? The counselors, trainers that they use when we're doing therapy is trying to give to you for a buck a minute. That's changing the paradigm of mental health. That's what really we're trying to do. But also, if you're an athlete, if you're a high performance athlete and you either are competing or are thinking about not competing anymore or trying to find a way to push yourself past maybe not competing anymore or a loss or injury, even maybe you've been experiencing some sort of depression type feeling for a long time related to once sports was over, or once you lost, or once you decided to walk away from the game, or if you're a fighter in the game, a football player, whatever it is, whatever your sport is, volleyball, but doesn't matter, whatever your sport is if you're in it, I can be either a mental coach in your camp. I do that personally. I don't Mr. Miyagi you. I don't help you focus in the gym, if you will, directly. What I do is help you keep your life balance outside of the gym. I help your relationships stay good, right? Not about blocking it out, right? And zenning out so you can fight or so you can participate or compete. No, it's the idea of keeping that in a balanced state so it doesn't interrupt your pure focus potential. Because when an athlete's competing and can have pure focus potential, well, then you perform, you become this super athlete. But you step in an MMA fight for a minute and think for a second that your wife is cheating on you. Or your child may be hurt or sad, right? Let these things affect your training for a second. It will impede you. It can drive you and help you at certain emotional states, but can also distract you. So that's what I do from a coach in your camp standpoint. If you have some scheduled, you have a competition on the rise, I help you work your way toward that by keeping a life balance on the outside. Or if it's time to move on and grow a life beyond that or come back from loss or injury, I do that. I call it athlete mental training, recovery coaching, or simple mental training. But just go to adamlowry.com, the website for the podcast, the book, everything else. Amazon is where you can find the book, actually. And you can actually book a session on there with myself doing some athlete mental training. But last, drink my coatee. Go to drink my coatee. It almost flows out sometimes. Let's try that again. Look, drink my coatee. Drinkmycoatee.com. Go to there. pH, beautiful, clean water. My buddy Alfred, his crew. I love it. Probiotics, mushrooms, nectar of the gods, people. Nectar of the gods. My coatee. Boom. Probiotics, all the same. Cognitive Rampage, my coatee. Dollar Mental Health Club, athlete mental training. Tony Wright, dropping bombs. Oh, my God. I got to go. Rest my brain after that. Comfortable silence. Hope you're taking care of you. Hope you're living your cognitive rampage. Love you.